All right, good evening, everybody. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, August 7th, 2017. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern till midnight. If you're listening over another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 515-604-9386, and our participant code is 419303. I'm pretty sure I could change that and update that. That is the right numbers, isn't it, Jan? If your cell provider blocks or charges for the call, you can call in our backup number, which is 781-838-3728. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send your questions to questions, it's plural, questions, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save America. Also, please support National Liberty Alliance by donating $5 a month or more. You can click on our donation tab up on the top right-hand side. Okay, like always, we'll start off with some scripture reading. We're going to read tonight Matthew chapter 13, verses 44 through 52. So we're going to be picking up on the parables right where we left off last week, or the last couple of weeks, actually. Again, Matthew chapter 13, verses 44 through 52. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like unto treasure hid in a field, the which, when a man hath found it, he hideth, and for joy thereof goeth and selleth all that he hath, and buyeth that field. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like unto a merchantman seeking goodly pearls, who when he hath found one pearl of great price, went and sold all that he had, and bought it. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like unto a net that was cast into the sea, and gathered of every kind, which when it was full, they drew to shore and sat down and gathered the good into the vessel, but cast the bad away. So shall it be at the end of the world. The angels shall come forth and sever the wicked from among the just, and shall cast them into the furnace of fire. There shall be wailing and gnashing of teeth. Jesus saith unto them, Have ye understood all these things? They say unto him, Yea, Lord. Then said he unto them, Therefore every scribe which is instructed unto the kingdom of heaven is like unto a man that is a householder, which bringeth forth out of his treasures things new and things old. Okay, that was Matthew chapter 13, verses 44 through 52. Okay, we put together a paper, which we did file up on our website, up on the... Oh, goodness, what is it? Under docket. So it's nationallibertyalliance.org/docket, or go to nationallibertyalliance.org, highlight grand jury, and click on docket. And you can find the paperwork there that we just filed up. And I believe it's called the grand jury report regarding the criminal investigation into 9/11. Now, actually, I don't think I actually called it that, but I'm going to go back up there and make sure I did that. But you'll see something up there that's on 9/11. Let me get onto that page and double check. Okay, it's called 9/11 evidence. It's down right above, right down towards the bottom, but it's right before the video. 9/11 evidence. It's a 254-page report by the grand jury regarding the criminal investigation into 9/11. It's dated August 7th. And I'm just going to kind of read the front page, a little bit on the front page. Obviously, I'm not going to read 252 pages. This is being filed in the courts tomorrow. It's being sent out, copied to the President of the United States. The copy will be sent out to Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General, also the Judiciary Committee, and a couple of other congressmen. And basically, it's a grand jury, sovereigns of the court, we the people against, and it says undisclosed, sealed defendants. So we haven't identified the defendants yet, but if you go through this, there are a couple of people that probably will be defendants that are in this paper. What we'd like everyone to do is download this. It's a PDF. Download it and read through it. because at some point in time, we are going to bring this up before the full grand jury for consideration of indictments of certain individuals. We're not doing that right now. We don't have any plan to do that in the immediate future, but things could change and we could do it next week. We have no clue on when we're going to do this. But we did want to get this evidence up into the court and get the grand jury starting to become acquainted with the evidence and reading it. It's going to take some time to go through all this, 252 pages. There's a lot of video here. They are clickable links in the PDF, so if you open it up on your computer, the links are clickable, and you'll be able to get to the videos. All of this evidence was really brought together by architects and engineers. It's very well done, very professional. It's frightening as they go through because, you know, well, we know what's going on, but a lot of people who don't know what's going on, they start reading this. It is frightening on what has happened on 9/11 and many other things. There's a connection to a lot of other things here also. But basically, let me just go through this. It's an evidence report to the by the grand jury regarding the criminal investigation into 9/11. On September 11, 2001, the three worst structural failures of modern history took place when the World Trade Center Building 1, 2, and 7 suffered complete and rapid destruction. In the aftermath of the tragedy, most members of the architecture and engineering community, as well as the general public, assumed that the building's destruction had occurred as a result of an airplane impact and fires. This view was reinforced by subsequent federal investigations culminating in FEMA's 2002 Building Performance Study and in the 2005 and 2008 report by the National Institute of Standards and Technology. Since 9/11, however, independent researchers around the world have assembled a large body of evidence that overwhelmingly refutes the notion that airplanes impact the fires, caused the destruction of the Twin Towers, the World Trade Center 7. This body of evidence, most of which FEMA and NIST, N-I-S-T, which is the National Institute of Standard Technology, admitted that their report instead supports the troubling conclusion that all three skyscrapers were destroyed in a process known as controlled demolition, where explosives and or other devices are used to bring down a building. The next page that's on here is the index, and then after the index we have all of the videos, a whole page of video links. Again, it's a PDF, but it is active links in the PDF. You might have to hit them two or three times or move it around the link until it kind of clicks on a PDF, but it will open up onto YouTube, as long as you're connected to the internet, obviously. And you can watch all of this evidence that these people have laid out in videos, point by point, subject by subject. Also, you'll find after that many, many, many reports from all kinds of different scientists, engineers, architects, psychologists, I mean, all kinds of people writing up reports and coming to the same conclusion and telling their opinion and thoughts prior to and after viewing the evidence and discovering the evidence in many cases on their own. So anyway, what we're doing, and what I mentioned, is we are filing this with the court. We're not going after anybody right now. But look, we are the grand jury. We have to stow away the reports and information and the evidence somewhere, and we've chosen to do that in this court right here up in New York, the Northern District, where we opened up a case. Made it clear that this was an Article III court under the common law, and we are stowing away evidence to be considered by the grand jury, and so on, and considered for potential indictments. The question is who are the targets, and that again, there's a lot of targets here. We're not at this point in time talking much about the targets. Now, what we're asking, we're going to ask, you know, I'm kind of surprised watching Fox News quite often lately. You know, I catch it on the internet, watching through YouTube, and I'm really surprised that Sean Hannity is coming out with a lot of truth, and a lot of people here at Fox News. I don't know what happened, but They seem to be coming out with a lot of truth. Maybe they see, not necessarily them, but the people behind the control, Fox News, maybe they see the writing on the wall and they're trying to get on the good side of the people. I have no idea why. Alex Jones has been reporting on this stuff and a lot of this stuff. And of course, we're starting to see other media here or there, nothing on the major media, but there's a lot of local small media also. So what we'd like people to do, I think it's inappropriate for the grand jury to send out a copy of this to these people, you know, to the news media. But anybody who is just a regular person and would like to send a copy to Fox News or to Alex Jones or to anyone else. Now, it is a big copy, you know. I'm copying them right now, and it prints out to be about at least an inch and a half, well, maybe 2 inches thick. It's 253 pages, so it's a half a ream. One ream is 500 pages, so a half a ream is, you can imagine the thickness of it. People can take a thumb drive, put it on a thumb drive, take it to Staples, and have them run it off if they want. They also have the huge staplers. I happen to have one. That they have these very, very big staples that you can actually put a staple through the 250 pages that big. So they can be put together that way. Otherwise, I'm not sure how you would want to compile it. The other thing, of course, it's an electronic copy, so an electronic copy could be sent out to the news medias also. So anybody who would like to do that, get this information out, they should. This could be the explosive thing. There was something today that happened, it happened on August 4th in the White House. I'm not going to talk about it or give details on it. I think Gerard knows more about that, and when I turn Mike over to Gerard, maybe he can give us whatever information he knows concerning what's happening there. I haven't had time to read the stories, but he did send me a few links. But anyway, let me first go forward before I put it over to Gerard. Oh, Gerard, do you want to talk about that now, what's going on there with the White House and what we discovered today? And I think it started on August 4th.
Yeah, I don't know. It's up to you. I mean,
yeah,
I don't have...
I mean, well, if you're not sure, then we'll skip it. You
know? Well, I want to bring that page up when I'm talking about it. I'm not just ready right now. So do what you're going to do and give me, in 5 minutes, I'll come in.
Okay, sounds good.
Just a couple of things I want to refer to, and I don't have that page open in front of me right now.
Okay.
Okay.
All right, let me first move over to Jan. Jan, do we have any questions?
Yes, this evening we have three questions for you. The first one, NLA, through the Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury, has filed a court case in a Class 3 court declared by the Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury.
It's called an Article 3 court, just to make a correction for that.
Right.
Go ahead.
Jury in Upper New York. How is that action going to be recognized when most practicing attorneys and Department of Justice / U.S. attorneys / district judges of the federal district court system believe the federal district courts are already a Class 3 court, plus they do not recognize the Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury? What is next?
Mm-hmm. All right, well, look at a couple of things. There's procedure and process. It is true that judges and prosecutors, lawyers, you know, they're gatekeepers of the process. And the way they've really been keeping control is keeping the people ignorant to the process of the court. And how to get into that court and how to file the papers and what the procedures are. It's kind of a hit and miss, and people, you know, kind of hit and miss it over time until they figure some things out. And until you get a course, the only course that I'm aware of that really teaches anybody that wants to get access into the court, the only course I'm aware of is jurisdictionary. Okay? And matter of fact, anybody who wants a copy of that course, they can click on our website, and on the right-hand side of our website, you will find a jurisdictionary. Hang on a minute, I'm going to try to get to that page. Okay, on the right-hand side of our website, you will find jurisdictionary. So if anybody wants to get that course, it is a course you have to purchase. It is the course that we had purchased years ago in order to learn how to write papers and get access into the court. But anyway, if you click on that icon there, I'm looking for it to make... I don't see it. How come I don't see it? Oh, it should be up on the top. Hang on a minute. All right, there it is. It's kind of small. I'll have to put a bigger one. It's right under our view calendar, and then you'll see Defend Yourself Jurisdictionary. Now, if you click on that, you know, you go to a page which will give you some basic information on that, and basically it goes to a web page off of our site. The guy is charging $249 for the course. That's what I paid, I don't know, 8 years ago or whatever it was that we did it. It was $249, so he hasn't changed his price. But if you do decide to buy it, no matter where you go, that's the price it's going to be. We ask that people click on our link so that NLA is attached to that, and we earn $50 for every course that we sell for this guy. So that helps the cause get some money into NLA to keep the lights on. I think they pay up to $125, but after you sell your first four or six or something, I think you have to sell, first two is $50, the next two is $100, and then after that you get $125 or $150. I think it was $125. But anyway, it does help us. I try to tell people that they should take this course, not just for us to make money, you know, to be able to keep the lights on, pay the bills, but also because people need to know how to write papers. They need to know the process and procedure. Okay, so anyway, getting back to the question now. There is a procedure in the court, there's a process, there's laws, and we use these laws. We use a paper called a file on demand. And the fact of the matter is that when a paper goes into the court, the clerk has no arbitrary decision-making here. They must file. They can't reject, refuse, return. They cannot conceal. The law is very clear and very stiff. And the penalty could be anywhere from 1 to 20 years, depending on if it becomes a conspiracy and if people are intimidated in order to do these things and so on and so forth. But anyway, we put that law on a paper called File on Demand to make sure that they are educated in the fact that they have to file. Once they put that stamp on the paper, okay, that now becomes a filed piece of document, and it also has the stamp, the timing of when this was filed. It is then uploaded into PESA, and there may be other companies that offer information to get access, but I know of PESA. So you go to PESA, and PESA has that information logged up there. So the purpose of opening the court is to get it on record. So every paper we've ever filed is on record. Now, we're going through PESA now to make sure that every paper we did file is on PESA. And if we find papers that have not been filed, okay, then we're going to start going after these people up there for concealment, destruction, destroy, removal, or whatever it is. It's all the same thing. But generally speaking, the information is there. The other thing is that we're coming in as the grand jury, representing as the grand jury who are the sureties of the peace, which represent the people. Whenever a court case is written, you know, or opened to go against somebody in a criminal matter, it's always the people versus, and then whoever that person is. They constantly bring cases up in our name. In many cases that we don't approve of, they do it anyway. Even in the federal courts, it's the United States versus. Well, we the people are the United States. It's us that we the versus them. So we put our name up there as the people, the sureties of the peace, the grand jury, okay, the sovereigns of the court. And then we file these cases. Now, we're filing a lot of cases inside here, lots and lots of cases, lots of information. The whole purpose of this court case is really to get before a court, a common law court with juries, tribunals, which are the people, the juries. And it's not that all of it will be decided by one jury. There are many, 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 many trials involved in this case. And it spans across the entire nation. And ultimately, when you put it all together, it's subversion against the United States of America by enemies both foreign and domestic, and particularly and specifically in the judiciary. So all of that information, again, is up for people to see. We also post it up on our website. So that's a pressure, and it's building up more and more and more. We know that some of these people up there in the court are fear not recording it, and maybe on the upper level, some of those people fear recording it. The question is who do they fear more? But, you know, the lower people, the clerks and stuff, they have no clue on what's really going on the by the status quo. So they, with a fear, are filing it. The other thing, of course, is our communications with the president, which we've been having for, it's a one-way communication street, though. But the message was sent back quite some time ago that the president-elect, when he was president-elect, and even before that, he was interested in our stuff. So we got word, secondhand word from his administration that he's interested in this stuff. So we have filed everything we filed. We've sent a copy to the president, and we'll be sending a copy of this to the president also. Also, we send copies to three different congressmen, one of them which is the committee chair for the Judicial Committee, and we send a copy to Jeff Sessions. So we have it out there. It's in so many places. You know, for them to erase it, it's quite a bit of work for them to do. If we get copies of these papers into the news, that would be advantageous also. But particularly this paper that we're filing now, I think, is the important one. And we're going to talk a little more on how the timing is right now right for this. I was a little leery about moving on this at this point in time. We put this together over the weekend, brought all this evidence together. And I was back and forth on filing, but then we got some news and we realized this is the time to file it, so we filed it. Now, we also have critical mass, okay? We have over 6,000 members and climbing. We have name recognition. We're known by all of the federal courts and the state courts. They're aware of us. They're familiar with us. Everyone has received papers from us over the years. So we have name recognition. We have name recognition in the Liberty Movement. We get tens of thousands of hits on our website. I forget the percentage, but I think it's something like, I don't remember whether it's 40% or 60%, but 40% of the hits are people who are newcomers, or maybe 60% are newcomers. I don't recall the last time I looked at those statistics, but that's been pretty constant, you know. Let's say 40% of the people are people that are coming to the site for the first time. And so we got a lot of other people that are watching us and don't become members. But we got a lot of people that are familiar and aware of us. And what are we looking for in order to succeed? Two words, critical mass, period. We hit critical mass, that's it. We win, this court goes forward, and we prosecute. The other way, of course, is if the president makes some moves and puts the pressure on to Jeff Sessions, and we're going to be putting some pressure on him soon, by the way, and his office, and big pressure, in my opinion. But he needs to move, and he needs to send some U.S. Attorneys who are prosecutors to prosecute these cases. And, you know, let's take the Russian investigation. I read somewhere there are 450 attorneys on that case. Just think about that. 450 attorneys. All right? Now, I'm sure they had to call outside help for cases like that. But, I mean, why so many people? They don't even have anything. But in any event, that's what they got. Well, if they have 450 people on that case, working that case as attorneys, how much more should we have? We need 450. We probably need a lot more than that even, people who work these cases. We have tremendous amounts of information. The other problem, of course, is RICO in the courts, and we're trying to expose that. RICO at the highest level, but the judiciary is the one that's really exercising it. What's going on right now, I think the timing is perfect. We have worked for many years to get to this point. We started working in the courts as National Liberty Alliance. We're trying to move into the courts under the name of National Liberty Alliance since December of 2012. Okay, so we've been working at this for, 5 years now. And in those 5 years, we've organized, we've educated, we've communicated information across the nation. And again, we've accomplished a lot of goals. And we've positioned ourselves in such a way as to have the backing, the people, the education, the evidence, and everything else in different cases. And we've opened an Article 3 court, and we made it clear how that Article 3 court is to operate by our paperwork through memorandums. And if you want to know how we're controlling the court, read our memorandums. We the people, can use these memorandums. You know, you can cut things out or add things in and create your own memorandums, which run the process of these, you know, memorandums. Ultimately, usually, depends on what the memorandum is about. But if it's a memorandum of law, you're trying to make a position or a point or a conclusion that you want that judge to operate within, and want that court to move within, you know, you have to lay that case out in a memorandum. And ultimately, that really is notifying the judge of the law, you know. It's telling the judge to take judicial notice. And that kind of a statement normally would be done in your paperwork and referred to a memorandum, or take judicial notice of a particular law, with constitutional fact, law, or principle of common law, or whatever the case may be. So all of that collectively is how we expect to maintain and keep and exercise and execute judgment through a Article III court, which is a common law court, one that is run and decided by we the people, called tribunals, untainted by any jury, by any statutes, and by any prosecutor. So that's kind of our plan, and it's the plan, really it's the only plan available to anybody, really, to get things, make changes. You got to build pressure up, and you got to get critical mass, and you got to get the law. Look, once we get into the court and we start to run just one, we did one indictment, and once that judge is brought to justice and penalty is, he gets into the court and is being tried, whatever that penalty is one thing, but just once that trial starts, okay, we have success, and everything else will just funnel right through. It'll be like the opening of a dam, you know, it's just going to flow right through, and then we'll bring justice back into the courts. Of course, we have to prevent people from coming in and taking, trying to get control with you know, anger and looking to get even and that kind of stuff. We have to make sure that anybody that we allow into this process, they're required to fulfill certain requirements, which is our courses to begin with, and also take a vow of sense of honor, justice, and mercy, a vow to God concerning that, written, signed, and sealed, and filed within their courthouse. And then we need to police ourselves to make sure we don't become them. Because once we start to act with vengeance, with anger, with hatred, we become no better than them. We have to act with honor, justice, and mercy. It doesn't matter how angry we are. It doesn't matter how much we believe justice needs to be applied. Because ultimately, even if we get to the end of time and they haven't been you know, righteously judged for whatever it is, that's in God's hand. He's the final judge anyway. So we just need to apply the justice with honor and mercy. And so that's kind of our plan. Hopefully I answered that question, Jan.
Yes. Okay, next question. Is there any new news on the Bundy trial going on? InfoWars commented that one person was given 68 years in jail.
Yeah, we heard about that last week. We spoke about that last week a little bit. And we're looking for documents concerning that information. We have a tremendous amount of evidence to put into the court for the Bundy trial, for the Lavoie-Finucane assassination, both trials that took one up in Oregon and the other one down there in Nevada, and we have other cases also we're going to be pursuing. But that case, the Bundy cases, which is two of them, we definitely are going to start posting. We are going, and we've been talking about this for a while. Time is not here to be able to get all this stuff done. We only have so many people working with us on these things. So it's hard for us to get all this paperwork done and out, but it just takes time. We are working on the habeas corpuses as far as the ones that we've already applied to go after these people with a show cause and then see where we go after that. And once we get that paperwork together, I think the Bundys will be the first ones we'll deal with on that level to go after these judges who have rejected. Also, we're going to want to do a show cause on these judges by what authority they think that they can prevent people from defending themselves. It is clear, even in our Constitution or our Bill of Rights, that we have a right to defend ourselves. It's an unalienable right. And no judge has the right, the ability, the authority to reject or refuse any evidence coming into the court. Any evidence. I can't think of one case where they can prevent evidence from coming into the court. These people have been prevented to bring evidence into their court, and this is common. This has been going on for quite some time, and I hear so many cases, so many people I've spoke to, that people in jail for years on end. So I know this is going on for at least 20 years, and I'm sure longer than that. But in any event, where people have tons of evidence to prove they're innocent. But they go through this year of coming together, you know, in the court to decide on this and to decide on that. They call them conferences. So they come in, and the whole thing is about getting rid of evidence, preventing the defendant from winning their case. And I know of a lot of cases, and I'm thinking of one in my mind right now particularly, where they have tremendous amounts of evidence, really good, solid evidence. I mean, even this guy up in Montana, he had engineering evidence which refuted everything that the government threw at him, and they would not permit that evidence to be heard in the case. Okay, so they have gatekeepers. These judges are gatekeepers to prevent people's unalienable right to defend themselves, and therefore the jury never gets the other side of the story; they only get the lie, and it's always padded. So that's a problem. All right. Anyway, what exactly was the question again, to make sure I answered that?
Yes. What news we had.
Oh, okay, the Bundy news. Okay, news right. On the Bundy news. Yeah, I don't know if we have anything new. Maybe Robert has something he'll be speaking, or Ollie or something. And maybe they want to update us on that. But that's what we have. We did speak last week. Any other questions?
Yes, the last question is there any way that they can take the house after the show cause is presented? Thanks. I realize there are variables, but someone knowing what they are doing, thanks. Do we file the show cause into the local federal courts?
Okay, that's very interesting, because first of all, we will file the show cause to the judge, and we will file, you know, serve a show cause to either the, if it's a tax thing, it could be either the comptroller or the treasurer. It depends on who's signing the papers there. On the other side of things, if it's a mortgage company, we usually go after the CEO. So they get their papers served, and we send a copy out to the individual who we're assisting, who is the petitioner, and we're just helping them as a next friend to get their paper into the court. Being that it becomes a federal case, because it's been moved into the federal case through that paperwork for cause, okay, then at that point in time, the lower courts cannot proceed. So the law prevents them from going forward. Now, that doesn't mean they're not going to go forward, but legally, lawfully, they cannot go forward. we command them not to go forward, but to respond and release. But what the people can do that file these papers that petition us for the filing of these papers is when you get the copy of the paper, make copies of the paper. And you can go. We thought about giving people list pendants. I think I'm not sure exactly how to pronounce that. List pendants, I think it is. But anyway, the form for them to copy that. But then we thought about that. Wait a second. Why don't we just file the case? I mean, it's like 15, 16 pages. I mean, it's powerful. So what people need to do when they get their papers in the mail, that means that the judge has got it. That means that either the county for tax or the mortgage company has got it, and you got it. You make copies of it. You take a copy down to the sheriff, and you file it with the sheriff. You wanted this to be filed with the sheriff to let them know that if this comes up for them, these people to come to take my home, they're threatening me to take my home now, I want you to know that this case is being heard in the federal court, and that stops everything on this level. Then they may not tell you, but I'm telling you. You want to then just go down to your courthouse where this paperwork is being filed. You'll find a number, an identification number, and make sure a copy of this case is filed in the case. The other thing is to take it down to the county clerk, get up to the real property, and make sure it gets filed in the files with your title. Okay, for the home. And now everyone's been served. It's much more powerful than a list pendants. But everyone's been served. And if they go forward without this case being finalized here, then they're breaking the law. And there's penalties for that. And we will help pursue those penalties because that becomes a criminal action. Actually, if they continue to take you home in any way, that's a criminal action, non-judicial foreclosure. They ignore the habeas corpus. They're ignoring due process. Again, these are all great violations that there are even codes written for this purpose for those people who are in power and use the cloak of power to operate under the color of law, in other words, using their authority to break the law. So there's a lot involved that can be done, but it's up to the individual to be active to do all these filings. We probably should make a note of this, what people need to do. But basically what I just told you is it. That's it in a nutshell. Sheriff gets a copy, get a copy into the real property, get a copy into the court itself. Where else? I think that's the only three. And again, the mortgage company will already have a copy, and the judge. All right. Anything else?
No, that's all of the questions. I guess Robert would say something about the Bundy trial.
Okay. Is Robert with us?
Yes.
I see him out there. Okay. He's muted right now.
You want to click him? He's unmuted now.
Is Ollie out there? Does he have anything to say on this, too?
I haven't heard from Ollie.
Okay, Robert must be away from his computer right now because I don't hear him, and I see his mic is unmuted.
Hey, John?
I
can go over that other thing now if you'd like. I'm ready.
All right, let's do that, and then we'll try to get Robert again. I'm going to mute Robert, and
I just got a note from Robert that he's talking, but we're not hearing him.
Oh, boy.
Did he hit his red phone?
There we go.
Well, yeah, his phone is open. I don't know.
Yeah, you're unmuted on the board. Well, he's muted now. Did somebody mute him? Let me try and unmute him.
Yeah, I did. Unmute him. Go ahead, Robert. You're unmuted. Robert once. Robert twice. Robert three times. All right, well, maybe he can figure out his problem. Let's move over to Gerard, and then we'll come back to Robert. Okay?
Good.
All right. I'll meet Robert meanwhile.
You can leave him open. You can leave him open. He's not making any noise. Anyway. Okay, this thing that came through on the Liberty Beacon is where we got it, this article about Trump being evacuated from the White House after they discovered a massive 9/11 spy system. You know, I don't know if any of you guys remember, but they were remodeling the White House after 9/11. And that plays into this because they believe that that's when all the spy systems were put in the walls and stuff. And this was a conversation between the Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and one of the Russian foreign ministers, Sergei Lavrov. So, oh, here we go, the Russian thing again. But I don't think that they would have let this out. And, I mean, he's definitely out of there. He did leave, so that kind of lends to the credibility of this. And I don't believe Donald Trump's trying to pull any kind of false flag news. Anyway, there's an awful lot of in this article, and I won't read it all because I'll just paraphrase it. You know, they didn't want anybody talking about 9/11. I mean, look, at for a couple of years, if you said that it was anything but a jet crashing into the building, they acted like you had six heads. I knew the day it went down it wasn't a jet crashing into the building. When I watched it go down, I knew immediately. And then I began to hear all the theories on different things that were going on. And believe me, there's numerous, voluminous evidence on some of the research that I've even done that just, you know, you hear people getting convicted for murder due to circumstantial evidence. Well, there's hard evidence, but the circumstantial evidence alone is so weighty it falls over. I mean, look at it, that the 9/11 attacks were the biggest short sale day in the history of the stock markets ever, since ever there was stock markets. These guys couldn't even help themselves. They had to sell the airline short that they knew whose stocks were going to go down that were going to be involved in this thing. And of course, we don't know who those corporations that were betting against, you know, short selling the market, because don't you know, all those records went down with Building 7, which wasn't hit by anything, but it had all the records in it of all this money that they made. So it gets, the more you look into it, the more ridiculous it gets. But anyway, sticking to the article, that's just one of my own things. You know, they said, oh, well, Donald Trump decided to become president when Obama regime openly mocked him at the annual White House Correspondents' Dinner. But Tillerson says that's not true. He said Donald Trump was determined to become president when one of his friends got killed in those towers, and he knew that it was not what they were saying it was. And so he figured the only way he was going to get to the bottom of it was to become president. So he's had, obviously, a plan to be in there and a plan to undo this. And they claim that as soon as he got in as president, he started looking for the documents on 9/11. Well, that's one of the reasons that they're probably running around like crazy, because that's what they don't want. And that's what part of all this spying was to keep down, you know. Let's see. I want to bring up this guy, Robert Mueller. And he says here, Robert Mueller, the bulletin states, that he's a longtime known deep state operative who in 2005 personally ordered grand jury probe into President Bill Clinton's pardoning of the international fugitive Mark Rich, closed for reasons never explained, whom President Clinton had pardoned just hours before he left office, but who had received from Mark Rich's wife, Dennis Rich, millions in donations. Most critical, however, to note about Robert Mueller, this bulletin states, is that he was also at the front of the deep state sham in 9/11 anthrax attack investigation, which were a series of attacks that began the week after 9/11 using deadly army militarized anthrax spores. And you see, that's why they knew this was a government operation, because those anthrax spores they use, only the military has them. They have a DNA signature, and it was done, and it did go back to military grade, which, where do you get that from? Anyway, but whose militarized anthrax force, but whose investigation conducted by Mueller targeted an innocent man named Stephen Hatfield, and that so destroyed his life. A U.S. federal court ordered Robert Mueller to pay Hatfield $5.8 million, and with no one ever being charged for this and the other 9/11 deep state crime. So this is all stuff that, you know, is out there, but now it's coming to a head. And this is the thing that's going to bring these people down that have been in there covering up, making money, funding themselves. You know, we got trillions and trillions of dollars missing, and nobody knows anything, and everybody's stupid, and we're stupid, and we got a Vice President Cheney who has companies that get military contracts on all this stuff that they muck up over in the East. I mean, how stupid can we be, and how stupid have we been letting them get away with this? But this looks like this is the first turn. This is the first good news, really good news, and God only, you know, put your seatbelts on, because who knows where it's going to go. I mean, they're right now, they're ripping the walls of the White House out, and they're redoing it, and they're taking all the bugs out that were put there by President Obama, you know, back in 2009. And they know that Mueller and Obama are complicit in this. Mueller was the head of those agencies while this was going on. So it doesn't look good for him, and hopefully, you know, Donald Trump has the wherewithal and the ability to hold up to this. I mean, it looks like he's got a Marine general in there that's on his side that's pretty good. He's the one that ordered the evacuation of the White House. So,
yeah, what's his name? Do you remember? Do you know?
I don't know if it says in this article. I think it says.
Maybe someone someone out there knows who the name is. I think he's the chief of staff, right? I'll Google that.
Yeah, he was, but I know he was an ex-Marine. He's a retired Marine general. Well, when you're a general, you're never retired because you have national security under your belt, you know. Let me see. I don't see it here, but yeah, I'm sure somebody can find it out there.
Okay, Kelly. Kelly's the new chief of staff. So he's a general. Let's see. I'm looking to see his rank. But go ahead. He's definitely a general. Okay, I don't know how many star, but go ahead.
Right, right. So he ordered it because, you know, and you know, look, I kind of figured Trump had a plan because you can't go in there and do what he's going to do without having support, military support, CIA support, FBI support. So I think he's been working all these years to figure out who he could trust and go in with a team of people. Obviously, you know, you're playing chess here. You can't just go in.
Well, remember the very first group of people. Remember the very first group of people that Donald Trump spoke to when he became president. The very first group was the CIA. So, and they were very happy and pleased. He got quite a few, you know, just standing response. Okay.
Another interesting thing, he says here, Secretary Tillerson said to Minister Lavrov that upon taking office, President Trump immediately came under a withering attack from deep state operatives within the U.S. government when he began requesting classified documents relating to the 9/11 attack, with these deep state forces then pitting against Trump a special prosecutor named Robert Mueller. Mueller. Anyway, that's kind of what's behind the scenes on this. And, you know, just stuff is getting leaked out. I mean, you're not going to see it on the regular news. They have they're all run by the cabal. So why would they report this? They're not going to report this until they're forced to report it.
That's not bad.
So don't expect to turn on CNBC or CBS.
That's amazing. This happened on the 4th. It's amazing. And it isn't on any news anywhere. I mean, that's Friday. That's recent. So, but nevertheless, it's what? 1, 2, 3 days ago.
So, you know, that just goes to show you the control that they still have. And, you know, the only thing that Donald Trump has is talking to the people through his tweets and through the internet. And they want to stop him from doing that. They can't, you know what I mean? They can't stand the fact that he talks to the people. And I saw another article, and the guy said, look it, why would we stop talking to our base? That's what you do. And by the way, our people, our base is growing every day. And I do believe that that's the truth, because people have had enough of the baloney of this whole Obama administration and all their socialistic, communistic ideas and all the damage that they're doing to the country. So I think that, you know, popular opinion is with the president, but we'll see how it all fleshes out when it all gets done. You know, I mean, look, they do have control of the news media. I don't know how much longer that's going to go on. You know, at some point we got to, you know, the media has to be fixed. It's a First Amendment thing, so it has to be very careful. You can't just go in and close them down. But certainly, you know, some of the stuff they're doing, it borders on treason and subversion. And I think that they just need to be charged and taken out, and then just, you know, new people be put in. You know, once they know that we're under the law and there's law and order, they'll behave and they'll report the news. So, you know, and I mean, there's a lot of reporters that are very, very frustrated because they can't get their stories out and they always get killed. This is truly, truly a breath of fresh air for these people. And that's like John said, that's why he had Donald Trump had so much support of these guys in the FBI and the CIA that just know that the whole thing stinks. You know, and that they're so unconstitutional in the stuff that they're doing, and they're all compromised. It's just, you know, it's enough to make you throw up, man, get sick to your stomach. I mean, there's something wrong with you if you look at this mess and it doesn't disgust you. So hopefully the tide is turning, and it's not going to be easy, and it's not going to happen overnight. But each little step is a step in the right direction, and that's part of what we're doing here, because the cabal, the deep state, is suffering from the death of 1,000 cuts. And believe me, there is 1,000 cuts. And we're not the only ones out here attacking them and holding their feet to the fire. There's lots of other groups. I mean, Judicial Watch is on them, like, forget about it, calling them out. I heard, what's that judge there, the one that's on Fox News there? She's on fire. I'm surprised. They let her talk. But, you know, it wasn't so long ago, none of that stuff would ever get out. You know, what's his name, the retired Supreme Court judge there, and her. I mean, the stuff that they're putting out on Fox, it's like, look, if as long as it's going out on the airwaves, these people who are asleep with their cognitive diffidence, that they refuse to believe that their government would do such stuff. When you got people like retired Supreme Court judges and this other judge that's on there, it breaks open their blinders, and that's what needs to happen. You know, some people will not wake up until they see it on the news. And so anytime we can get something out there, and that's what we're going to do using social media and all this stuff. You know, I was talking to Ollie today, and he said, they think they're going to control YouTube and Facebook. He said, there's so many people posting this stuff and reposting it. What are they going to do? They have to close the whole thing down to control it. You see, they're getting overwhelmed with you know, pretty soon their system won't work. If they close everybody out that talks about 9/11, close everybody out that puts the truth out there about, you know, what's going on, pretty soon they'll be useless, you know. And basically it's a violation of our First Amendment rights, all of it is, but it's so big now, I don't think they can stick the genie back in the bottle. I really don't. I think it's out now, and it's like, you know, it's like steam that comes out of a bottle. It comes out small, and then it just expands as it hits the air. And I think that's what you're seeing now. You're seeing this big puff of steam coming out, and it's going to spread all over. So anyway, that's, and that article is the Liberty Beacon, and you can probably Google it. It says Liberty Beacon, Trump evacuated from White House after massive 9/11 spy system discovered. And if you put that in there, you can read it for yourself and take it for what it's worth. But I think it's pretty good. I don't think that, you know, Liberty Beacon has been pretty, has been dang good in my experience. So anyway, I'm done. That's it.
Okay. All right. Jan, is Robert back? Let's see if
yep.
we got him.
Can you hear me?
He's on.
Go right ahead, Robert.
Yep.
Okay, finally success.
Hey, by the way, just before Robert starts, just by the way, there is a desktop app that, you know, freeconferencecall.com offers. I was trying to cut and paste the link and put it onto our page, but it's not working. I'll try to figure that out, and I'll talk with the techs tomorrow and see how we can put that link directly to it, because it's very hard to find. We were trying to find something like this the other day, but I just found it now. But go ahead, Robert.
Okay, well, as far as the Bundys, the prosecution's case was supposed to end today. I'm not sure whether it did or not yet, but it was supposed to end today. Now, once again in this trial, they let BLM sit in the courtroom before they testified. So they were sitting there talking to the prosecutors while the trial's going on, and then they were called on to testify. Plenty of time for coaching. Now, we go into the defense part of the case. They're not allowed to talk about what the BLM did, such as killing cattle and destroying water tanks and piping or any of that stuff. Anything that's negative about the BLM, they're not allowed to bring up. so, you know, no fair case in this trial at all. And I think, well, some people are feeling like because the juries have the ability to ask questions, and they're, you know, as I said last week, they're asking questions of the judge and of the prosecution and of the defense, but they're also asking questions of the people on the stand testifying. And there's some that's in the belief that because of that, it's kind of showing that that the jury is not totally believing the prosecution. I think they're starting to see the fact that the defense is being limited and not allowed to say much. I know the next case is due to start next month, so they're not going to let the defense go very long. I'm thinking probably 2 or 3 days, and the defense are not going to have anything more they're allowed to bring out. Now, Ammon Bundy was able to make a call out and was doing a Q&A session with people that had been sending in questions and stuff. It didn't take long for the prison to shut him down, not let him finish, because he was teaching Constitution. So that's about all I have at the moment.
Okay, thanks, Robert. Jan, is there anyone else that wants to make any...
No, that's all that I know of.
Okay. All right.
Brent here.
Is Brent available? I was looking for him before. I didn't see him in here. Is he here?
Somebody just unmuted.
There, I got him unmuted.
Oh, there he goes. Thanks. Do you have the new host code, Brent?
I do, but yep. I tried to punch it in several different ways, and it couldn't get it to take. So
is he showing up as host, Jan, on, or just someone
no,
signing in?
No, he was not.
Okay. All right, well, we'll fix that during the week. Right now, we got you, so go right ahead.
Okay.
We're going to move over to Brent Winters, the author of The Excellence in the, of the Common Law. Brent's website is commonlawyer.com. Brent, go right ahead.
Thanks, John. We're talking about the laws of nature, and the laws of nature is God. The laws of nature, Blackstone tells us, volume one of his four volumes on his commentaries of the laws of England, popularly known as the commentaries on the common law, he tells us in those volumes that that phrase, laws of nature and laws of nature is God, which is also written into our Declaration of 76, refers to the two volumes of our fundamental law as Americans. Now, he didn't say it was our fundamental law as Americans because he delivered those lectures in the year 1765, and they were printed then after that. But Tom Jefferson lifted that phrase from Locke, and Locke had included it in his writings. What it means is this, and this is what Blackstone says, and this is the way Locke understood it, and this is the way the Scottish Enlightenment understood it. It wasn't new to these folk in that day. The laws of nature is the first volume of God's revelation of his will to man. The first volume is unwritten, as Blackstone puts it, lex non scripta. That means law not written. Why he uses Latin words, I suppose he was inundated with them. He couldn't help but spit them out, but it just means law not written. That first volume, not written in the nature of things. You can see the laws, the revelation, the revealing of the will of the Creator in what he has made. There are some things that are just that away, and there's no change in them. What goes up must come down. That's what we used to say. That's a law of nature. You can't change it. Now, if he wants to change it, he can and suspend it. And when he does such things, we call that a miracle. A miracle is the suspension of the laws of nature. And the one who made the laws has the right to suspend them. No one else does, by the way. None of us, and we shouldn't expect such a thing. Like, use the example of that picture. It was a poster, very popular for a while. Picture of a single-engine aircraft. Some kind of a high-winged thing, like a Cessna. And it was posed or perched in a tree. The wings were torn off, and it was perched in the top of the tree. This fuselage was just sitting there on some limbs. And the caption said that the laws of aviation are unforgiving. Well, the laws of aviation are the laws of the natural world, the laws of creation. And they are precise. Given any action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. They're precise to the nth degree. As Galileo said, they're so precise that mathematics is the language with which God has written the universe. That's the first volume, the laws of nature. Then that second volume, says our Declaration of 76, is the laws of nature's God written. Blackstone tells us, written in the Bible. The law unwritten, the revelation of the way things are, they will not change, unwritten in the nature of things. And the law written. It won't change either. In the Bible, the revealing of the will of the Creator, will. Law is always somebody's will. And the only true lawgiver is the Creator himself, says James, and it is his will that will not change. He does not change the way he has established his law for men. And he tells us explicitly. He tells us in so many different ways, particularly, as Blackstone puts it, by what he calls the Bible revealed religion, religare, a man's response back to his lawgiver, his final arbiter of right and wrong from whom there is no appeal. These are the fundamental laws of our country. This is the acknowledgement that those that have gone before us have made. And it is no accident that by acknowledgement of those standards, the laws of nature, unwritten the nature of things, and the laws of nature's God written in the Bible, that has an effect upon people. The acknowledgement of it. And pretty soon, then, those laws become part of their thinking. And they're repeated enough. People hear them. People talk about them. People are exposed to them, whether they understand it or not. whether they really know what's happening to them, whatever you expose your mind to, it's like a giant computer, G-I-G-O, as we used to say a long time ago. I haven't heard that for a while. Garbage in, garbage out. Whatever you put into the computer will come out of the computer. And whatever you put into the computer called your brain will come out. You may as well put good things in there, because if you put good things in there, eventually it will come out in your hands, your feet, and your tongue. You'll say right things, you'll do right things, and you'll go to right places. And that has an effect upon a people. And if, as is said, a critical mass of people get to doing the right thing, thinking the right thing, and then doing it, then everything changes. Things become better, not worse. As bad as they may be, they do become better. Well, let's go to the Declaration of 76. This is that document that acknowledges those two volumes, the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God. And Tom Jefferson knew exactly what he was saying and what he meant by what he said when he said that. Repeated John Locke, and John Locke knew what he was saying too, and so did William Blackstone. Isn't it curious, though, that it's never said, hardly, what that phrase means, and it is our fundamental law, as people say, organic. That means fundamental. That means foundational to our understanding of reality. Well, Declaration of 76, we're looking at the end of paragraph 2. And, we'll go on to paragraph 3. It says this, paragraph 3. He, H-E, who is he? He is King George III. He has refused to assent to laws the most wholesome and necessary for the public good. Why has he done that? Well, again, we remind ourselves, let's come back to the fundamentals. King George III was king, common law king in England. That means that his kingship was limited, not a little bit, a lot, limited by the other branches of the government, the legislative branch, parliament, the judicial branch. And as they say in England, the legislative branch is divided into two branches to divide it up even more of the power. And we've done the same thing here. We have two branches of the legislative branch, the House of Representatives on the federal level and the Senate. And in our state legislatures, many of them are that way. I think there are two that only have one house, if I'm not mistaken, just the House of Representatives, no Senate. Most states are fashioned with a bicameral. That means two boxes, with a two-box legislature. And if you go to Washington, D.C., for instance, you'll see two boxes at the Capitol building. On one side is a box, a big box that holds the Senate. On the other side is a big box that holds the House of Representatives and the state capitals. Many of them are that way, too. That box, they call a chamber, too. Bicameral is a word people use for some reason, another fancy word. But he has refused to assent to laws. Well, why has he refused to assent to laws? Because the legislatures here in the United States are in the colonies. He was king in England, but he was emperor here. Emperor, that means he was imperial. That means this is his imperium. That means he commands what he wants, and that ends the matter. There is no legislature. There is no judicial branch. Was there a judicial branch in the American colonies? Yes, there was. But the judicial branch is here. Now watch me close on this. This has a present application. The judicial branch is here. We're under the control of another power. They were just window dressing. That's what the government over on the other side of the pond wanted. They wanted people to feel like they had courts and all, but really what they wanted was to control the courts, reduce government to a single will. And our Declaration of 76 says that single will is King George III. But it gets more complicated than that. Just like Obama was a single will. But don't think he wasn't controlled by other men more powerful than himself. He was. He was nothing but a lackey for truly powerful men. Felt like he was in a nice position, pumped him up, but they controlled him. and he exercised a single will. Same way with King George. King George, unlike Obama, really was a nice man. Had 10 children, had a large family, was devoted to them. He loved gardening. He had a big garden, and he kept his garden himself. He worked it, weeded it. He promoted agriculture all over England. It was his favorite subject and his political ambition to make England agriculturally strong. But powerful men, bankers, the Bank of London, got hold of him. And when you're in a position like that, it's easy to be controlled. Easy? It's hard to be your own man, that's for sure. And so Tom Jefferson speaks of he, King George, he's responsible. The buck did stop with him, even though he was controlled by other people. That didn't mean that he didn't have responsibility to do right by the colonies, and he didn't. And he refused to assent to laws. We have control of courts. I said I wanted to apply this presently. It seems clear to me, as I look at the courts, although it's never spoken by them, but are our courts really independent? Are the judges really independent? That's fundamental of common law government, that the judiciary is not controlled by anybody. But it appears to me that there's a single will controlling the judiciary in many cases. I can't prove it, but it sure doesn't look right. It sure looks like that judges are following somebody else's playbook in many cases. I shouldn't say in all. I run into some good ones, some men that were willing to put their reputation on the line for what is right. But King George has refused to assent to laws. He has refused to assent to any power of any legislature. That's what he has done. That's what they're talking about. And unlike common law government, the law of the city, common law, the law of the land, as our Declaration, or as our Constitution, Article 6 says, unlike common law government, civil law is imperial. It is administered from a far-off central command, sending swarms of bureaucrats to force its single will. That's what King George was doing to the colonies. He was a far-off central command, sending swarms of bureaucrats. Thus, the law of the city spurns local representative bodies, hates them. Our Declaration of 76, paragraphs 3 through 10, decries the king's decree from afar, which denied the right to local legislative representation, including those representatives' right to set up common law courts with trial by jury. Thus did King George III place himself above personal rights. King George ignored his common law duty in the colonies. He said he was emperor. If there is no legislature, there will be no courts established. Legislatures, just like with our Constitution of the United States, our Constitution empowers the national legislature, the Congress of the United States, to set the jurisdiction of the courts, of the federal courts, except one. One federal court Congress has no say over. That's the Supreme Court of the United States. The Supreme Court of the United States is a creature, a creation of our Constitution of the United States. The Congress of the United States is a creature, a creation of our Constitution of the United States. And the Office of Presidency, the executive power, is creation of our Constitution of the United States. But the other federal courts, they are creations of Congress. All the federal trial courts and the jurisdiction they have is set by Congress. All of the appellate courts are established by Congress, and Congress has the power. He who has the power to give or establish has the power to take away. The Congress of the United States could eliminate every federal court in the country with a stroke of their pen by legislation. They certainly have the power, and beyond that, if they have the power to eliminate all of the federal courts except the Supreme Court of the United States, which is a co-equal power with Congress, if they have the power to eliminate every federal court in the United States, all the trial courts, all the district courts, all of the tax courts, all well, that the tax courts are part of the judicial branch, but all of the appellate courts, the Seventh Circuit, the Ninth Circuit, the First, Second, Third, Fourth, Fifth, right on up, all of them. And if they don't do that, they have the power to limit their jurisdiction. Say, you can hear this kind of a case, but you can't hear this kind of a case anymore. Or you can only hear this kind of a case, and that's it. Any court they establish. And I wonder why Congress has not done that for years and years and years. All the complaining they do about the courts. Well, I have a theory. Seems to me that Congress wants to throw the blame off on the courts and say, it ain't us, it's them. They're crazy. Those people out there in the Ninth Circuit are crazy. What do you mean the Declaration, or what do they call it, the Pledge of Allegiance is unconstitutional? What do you mean, Ninth Circuit? Well, if you really are convicted about what the courts are doing, Mr. Congressman, why don't you introduce legislation to get rid of that court or limit its jurisdiction and say you can no longer hear cases about the Pledge of Allegiance or about abortion or about the freedom of religion or whatever you want, whatever you're upset about. I'm not making a statement about what ought to be done, but I am making a statement about Congress ought to be exercising some jurisdiction in this matter. And they're not. If you don't like what the judge is doing out there, you have two options, Mr. Congressman. Impeach the judge or eliminate the court or the jurisdiction of it for some of it. This Bundy trial, Congress could stop the whole thing if they really were convicted about it. Doesn't appear that they are. It seems like that everybody's playing off the same playbook. There's no independent judgment going on. There's no co-equal powers. They're all working together. And it is the glory of our form of government that government all hate each other in this sense. They disagree with each other, and they fight. And if the branches of government are not contending and fighting with one another, our freedoms are absolutely gone. If they all start agreeing, we don't want them to agree. We want them to contend with each other. It is true they all hate each other. I shouldn't have said it that way. Truth is, people in government hate each other. They do, you know, because they want each other's money. They want the money that comes through government to be allocated to them. I used to watch these kind of things go on in military life. And money would come to a command, and then the department heads, the officers, would fight over it. Oh, would they fight over it. Well, it's the same thing in government. This money comes to the departments of government, and then they fight over it. They're jealous. They're envious. They'll climb on top of each other and try to get the retirements built up. On and on the madness goes. Well, King George refused his assent to law as the most wholesome and necessary for the public good. Paragraph 4. He has forbidden his governors to pass laws of immediate and pressing importance unless suspended in their operation till his assent should be obtained. And when so suspended, he has utterly neglected to attend to them. For reasons our Declaration of 76 here states, our Constitution includes its 10-day rule. But notice in this, not that 10-day rule about pocket veto, but notice in this paragraph, he is commanding his governors. That his governors, it says. These are men that are not of independent mind either. You know, the colonies here in America were analogous to our states in some ways because they had received charters from the crown that granted to them the rights of self-governance. That's a contract, a common law. And our Supreme Court acknowledged those charters in the Dartmouth College case and said even the charter of the king establishing this university, or this college, it was college, Dartmouth College, still is a college, I think. It was established by a charter from the Crown of England, and our Supreme Court of the United States said, that's a contract. I don't care if it is from England. The state of New Hampshire cannot change it. It's a right of contract, so the contract stands. Our states are the same way. We're under an agreement. That's our Constitution of the United States. It is an agreed-upon statement as to what the law is. And we've made the agreement, and the states are sovereign under that. And as sovereign states, the federal government has no lawful right to commandeer, keyword commandeer, anyone in state government or anyone in the states. That's forgotten, too. That was the Prince case. Sheriff Mack was involved in that one. And the wording the Supreme Court of the United States used was commandeer. The federal government had come in and said, told the sheriffs, assembled in New Mexico and Montana and all over the country, but those were the two that filed suit, two governors from those states, and said, we don't believe that the federal government has the authority to command sheriffs to do background checks on firearms. And it went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court agreed. Before it was over, though, a federal judge was shot to death and killed. Didn't hear much about that. He ruled for Sheriff Mack. And the Supreme Court, though, backed him up. Paragraph 5, he has refused to pass other laws for the accommodations of large districts of people, unless those people would relinquish the right to self-representation in the legislature, a right inestimable to them and formidable to tyrants only. Now here the colonists charged the king, King George III, with refusing whole land areas of Americans our common law's protection, including courts and trial by jury, unless they knuckle under taxation without the right to local legislative representation. Thus, the signers of this Declaration of 76 declare that the mother country has violated common law's separation of power principle. And in this instance, by the executive, that is the king's meddling with the legislature, the king of England, by refusing to annex whole areas of newly settled wilderness until the inhabitants agreed to give up their right of sending representation to their legislature, held them hostage, you see. Either you give up your right to sending legislators, representatives to the legislature. If you don't give up that right, I'm not going to annex the territory where you live, and it's going to continue to be a wilderness without any rights at all. I won't protect you. I won't let anybody else go in there and protect you. And of course, things were pretty rough back then. Consider, now I don't know about, they were moving to the Appalachians at that time. I don't know about the Appalachians, but I can extend what happened in Kentucky, I think, back into those mountains. And we have on record at least, well, we know because it's written down, there are probably three, four times that many, 1,500 men, women, and children roasted alive by the red man in Kentucky. 1,500 about on record. It was rough to be in those wilderness areas without some kind of protection. And men were living like animals. Those were anyway. And then after they would roast people, and this isn't put in the books much, but they would eat them. Cannibalism was part, very much part, of the red man's life. And Mohawk were notorious for such things. Of course, they would eat the hearts out of people. You can go read all those things if you want to take time to go to the library and look them up, and all the records are there. But my point being, that protection was important if you could get a little more of it. And the people that moved into these areas, no question, risked their lives, the lives of their wives, the lives of their children. And we reside now on land that is safe and productive, I might add, because of the intrepid boldness of such people. But they'd like to have a little bit of protection if they needed it, if there were reports of uprisings that brought great danger to them and their families. Well, the colonist mindset was fixed in the traditions of centuries of Anglo-Dane common law, custom that the people choose their king from among their kith and kin. And then that king, in turn, was duty-bound to appoint judges, shire reeves, which came to be slurred into sheriffs, meaning county agents, and bailiffs to summon jurors. In short, the king was to put the machinery of courts in place and then stay out of the court's business. Well, that's what we have today, and this is the same custom we have under our Constitution of the United States. The executive, analogous to the king, appoints Supreme Court justices, or no, he places them up for appointment, and this was true of common law in ancient England also. He places them up for appointment. He sends their names along to the body of elders in ancient England called the Witenagemot, the white-headed men, the meeting of the white-headed men. And then they would say yea or nay to whatever the executive, the king, wanted to do. Well, same thing here, the Senate. Senate means old. We get our word senile from the Latin word senate. The old men, and they are a little older. You have to be 35 to be a senator. You don't have to be 25, I believe, to be in the House of Representatives. But he must have their assent before judges are appointed, just as it was in ancient England. Well, Americans later pushed beyond the frontiers, and they set up their own common law courts without waiting on government back east to do so. And in time, state and federal courts ratified the findings of these local courts. Examples of these courts abound. The first branch of common law government, of any government, any right government, we just use the word common law to describe ours, the first branch is the courts. The courts must come first. It is no accident that in the laws of nature's God, written the Bible, at the establishment of the nation called Israel, the first thing that happened was judges set to judge. There was no king. And the book of Judges records the history of how that played out. But courts had to come first. Judges have to come first. Well, you don't need legislature. You know, they say, even in England yet today, and I know it was true for years, and I remember a time when I knew it was true. I don't know if it's still true, but I assume it is. There is no statute, no legislation on the books that says that murder is a crime. None. Why? Well, because when someone's accused of murder and the jury is impaneled, the jurors don't need to be told that unjustified killing of another man is not wrong. It is wrong. They know that. And so when governments are established, it's important we go back and review how this all should happen and how it did happen in our own country. Courts were first. People knew, fundamentally, they had some customs in their minds. They didn't need legislation. They had the laws of nature. The way things are, they're not going to change. Rape, sodomy, murder, pedophilia, all of these things are crimes, and men do it by nature. It's unnatural. It's a crime against nature to do those things. Crime against nature, a crime against nature's God. Contrary to nature, contrary to the maker of nature. So men impaneled juries in the early days, and you'd go back and read these accounts. It's fascinating to understand how government is founded, and fundamentally what government is. So I say again, the independence of the judiciary, the independence of the courts, is the most fundamental independence of our common law government. And courts that are instructed by anyone else are not independent. I want to drop a footnote here and say that, you know, our Constitution, in pursuance of this standard of independence of the judiciary, says that the pay of federal judges cannot be changed during their tenure in office. It doesn't say it cannot be changed by Congress. It does not say it cannot be changed by this person, this part of government, that part of government. It just says it can't be changed. And if it happens, it's unconstitutional. And I say this, and I throw it out for your consideration. As long as the Federal Reserve Bank is in control of the value of money, the worth of it, by controlled and planned deflation and inflation, then the Federal Reserve bankers are changing the pay of federal judges. Justice Stevens said before he got off the Supreme Court, or before he was old enough to get off, I should say, he said he'd never seen morale so low among federal judges. Why? Well, when their salaries were set, they were pretty high. But then it didn't change for years, and now they're, by comparison, not high. Now, people say, oh, they're getting plenty of money, and they get perks, and all that may be true. But to pay attention to other people's problems and do a good job, a fellow needs to be paid a lot because everybody's got their own problems. I don't, myself, don't kick over the pay of judges. I know some of them get quite a bit. Some of them are pretty crooked. But at the same time, you have to pay a man if you don't even relax and pay attention to other people's problems. I was in a courtroom not long ago in another state out west. I was in a family law court with a fella trying to help him a little. And he did a great job. The judge was a Mexican. He's American, I suppose, but a Mexican. And he could even speak Spanish to some of the people in the courtroom. And I got the feeling from him, he was a pretty conscientious fella. And there were some pretty tough cases coming up in front of him. I don't know what I'd have done. He finally stopped one fellow that was screaming at him, and he said, I know. He was screaming at him because his children were being abused, and he didn't know how to stop it. The law was protecting the abuser. The fellow living with his wife, he said, I know. He said, I'm doing all I can, given the resources I have. Please be patient with me. This is not easy, and I'll try to help as much as I can. That was encouraging to me. Encouraging to me that a judge would just have enough kindness in him to be decent to people when dealing with things that are, well, they're life and death. Well, that's a little off the subject here. Let me get back to this, and then we'll quit. I just wanted to raise one example, and this is a beautiful example because it tells the difference. We're talking here about territories. Territories that are not annexed, refusing to pass laws for the accommodation of large districts of people. In recent history in America, this happened. It was inadvertent, but it happened. And what is today the panhandle of the state of Oklahoma was by apparently inadvertent oversight of Congress when they laid out the boundaries of the territories and the Indian Territory and Colorado and Kansas. They inadvertently left out a strip of land 38.5 miles wide and about 165 miles long. And in that strip of land congregated cutthroats from all over the world because there was no law, none at all. It was a barren kind of a place, and when I was growing up, I knew a fellow who went down there to homestead. He had died when I was a boy, but the stories he told were, well, they're high adventure. I wonder he lived through it. He eventually moved on to southern Colorado. But in that district, a strip of land about that wide, 165 mile long, 38.5 mile wide, the government, the Congress failed to include it in any territory or state, and so no laws were enforced there, no law enforcement was there, no organization of any government of any kind. And then, by the year 1907, the Indian Territory had become the whole thing, including the panhandle, was worse, and it wasn't part of anything, but it became an outlaw's lair, and the distant federal government in Washington, D.C. proved unable to bring peace, any amount of peace, and no amount of force of the federal government assuaged the lawlessness in Oklahoma, and it was worse than what is now the panhandle. And between 1875 and 1907, the federal court in Fort Smith, Arkansas, having criminal jurisdiction over white men in the Indian Territory, sentenced over 160 men to hang, but with absolutely no discernible effect on the crime. But upon obtaining statehood in the year 1907, Oklahoma, which by then included the panhandle, with its county courts and its immediate appointment of sheriffs, immediately peace emerged and grew, and prosperity exploded immediately. And it wasn't that the federal government didn't exert force. They exerted a lot of force, did all they could. But a distant government is not effective in any meaningful and good way in a faraway place. And that's what King George III was trying to do with the American colonies. It didn't work. That's what the federal government tried to do with Oklahoma. It didn't work. That's what the federal government is trying to do today. It's trying to make the states territories. It's trying to exert all the force it can. It's trying to steal the land. It, the people of it, the useful idiots, the Obamas, the Clintons, the Bushes, using the federal government to move into the states, destroy the sovereignty of the states, dominate the people, and, as Longfellow said, kick their butts and take their stuff. That's what the law of the city is all about. Dominating men and stealing. Not dominating the land, as is our common law, our law of the land, but local county government has always been our common law strength. From the Anglo-Danes to the Americans, and true law, common law government, says William Blackstone, being intolerant, a distant decree, brings the courts near and accessible to each person. The courts are the key, you see. And that's where we should focus our attention. I think NLA has been doing that, been working at it real hard. In more recent times, just to mention one other application of this principle of territories being ruled from distant places, Alaska's unorganized boroughs fall somewhat into this category of inhabitants having no meaningful representation in government. Most of the state of Alaska is unorganized in many ways politically. Well, they've got their courts out there. I didn't know that this was true until I was contacted by a friend in Alaska, and he urged me. He said, you must come to Alaska, and they're looking for a judge up at Tope. That's way up in the unorganized borough. Godforsaken almost wilderness. But they have a court up there. And he said, I want you to come up here and put your name in the hat. Well, to be a judge in one of those unorganized boroughs up in Alaska, all you need, according to the statute, is a high school education. That's all you need, a diploma from a high school. You don't have to go to college. You didn't have to go to law school. You don't need a law license. But they can't, see, get anybody to go out there. And so it's hard to govern from a distant city. And that's why our country separated from Britain, ultimately, because they couldn't do that. Well, nowhere is the natural horizon of common law courts, juries, and due process better seen than among the mining districts of the tin fields of Cornwall to Spain and from the gold fields of Georgia to California, where unlearned and yet able men all arrived at the same principles of common law government. Maybe we can talk about that at a different time. That's all I have, John, for now, but I want to make mention of one thing. A request came to me, and I don't want to forget it. I thought I should say something about it, but I won't do it today. A request came to discuss a lodeal title. What is a lodeal title? Does it have any meaning today? Can it be used to help us today? And I want to take time to do that, and I'm saying that as much to remind myself as I am to remind others that that's what I want to do. Well, thanks, John, and I'm
okay.
At the end of my comments.
All right. Thank you, Brent. Appreciate it.
Hey, John?
Yeah.
Listen, there's another kind of important announcement here because this George Webb is going to trial tomorrow. The guy that's got, like, all kinds of evidence on these rat lines and fits right into the whole thing that's going on with Donald Trump. And I want to put Harley on to alert people to what's going on. Go ahead, Harley.
All right, so in a nutshell, the nuances are that he's uncovered. It was very evident they were out tracking him that night when he was near the port, and they were trying to, they got him for being near his keys, sleeping. He could have run the vehicle. It's a very marginal charge to begin with.
DWI, in other
words. Yeah, so he's going in tomorrow for a pretrial hearing. And the thing that troubles me is he's pro se, and that was a similar situation I think Joshua Martinez was in when he got 15 days just for contempt of court because the judge didn't want his explanation or his questions even. He was mostly on a questioning foot. So at any rate, I'm putting it out there. People should watch the George Webb thing and help us. We should all, you know, who have the bandwidth, see how this is playing out, because it's really about access to the courts as we go. And, you know, he's, I think, possibly trying to balloon this up a little bit so that it gets more attention, but it's, as we know, a risky adventure. But that's really the big
point. What was the big thing he found in the port that they were smuggling in? That's what this is all about.
Okay, so
people don't understand. They don't know.
Right. He's got a reputation as some kind of live wire who made a false claim on the court, and he was very modest. He said, do the normal checks on the ones that are listed under diplomatic. A diplomatic pouch, by the way, can now be as big as a shipping container, which makes it very convenient for trafficking in cars.
And this is what Pelosi was doing with her daughters. They're doing this diplomatic pouching and smuggling drugs. And what Harley just said is their diplomatic pouch could be as big as a sea container. Hello?
Right. And so he's found these other really crazy things. And at this point, they were concerned about depleted uranium and dirty bomb materials and the like. And so just Jason Goodman, his partner, made one call after finding out they were trying to reach him. And one other person in the Crowdsource the Truth. But join us on Facebook. There's a group called Crowdsource the Truth. Friend Jason, friend George Webb, friend me. I'm William Blake on Facebook. So I will yield, and I just wanted to put that bug in everybody's ear.
Okay, thank you. All right, I guess we'll move to the Q&A. Let's see, Frank, we're going to leave you unmuted if you want to respond to any of the questions, but I don't know if you have a way to mute yourself on the other end because you're not coming in as a host. We'll fix that for next time. We'll go through that process with you. Also, before we open the Q&A, I did find an app I guess a reasonably easy way to get a hold of them for our Monday night calls here. And we put it up on our Monday Night Call page, so you can click on the link here. It says download the free conference call app. And it goes on to say, and go to the bottom of the page for the desktop app. They do have the different apps for the cell phones and the iPads and stuff very prominent on the page, but they don't have anything big for the desktop app. You have to go all the way down to the bottom and your tiny little words, desktop app. So you're going to want to click on that. And then you can call in. I think you have to put your you got to get a password and put an email address in there, a working email. And they ask you for a name. You know, you could just use your first name. And on the last name, if you don't want to use your last name, we ask people what their first name and state is. So put your first name and then your last, put your state. That'll be helpful to us to identify you and know where you're calling from. Okay, so that's available. I got it up. I got the link up on the site right now so people can use it next week. Also, anybody having problems calling in with the number we have, we do have a backup number. If it's busy or if it's a situation you're being charged, you call in the other number. It's a 781 number. Okay, with that, I guess we'll go to the next, to our first caller. Let's see. I'll first time using this board. Hopefully I don't hurt nobody here, but we'll click next. We have someone that has no identification on them. You've been unmuted. Well, let me go to the next person. That may just be a glitch in the system.
Yeah.
Okay, we have a. I guess we still have a person here with no name on there.
This is Terry in New Jersey.
Okay, Terry in New Jersey. Hang on one second. Let me see why this is that way. I wonder why there's a blank on that. Okay, Terry from New Jersey. Go right ahead.
Okay, first of all, I want to say dynamite conference call tonight. I got a question about, you talking about the 9/11 thing earlier, and when I went to grab my iPad, you had already given the place to find it on the site, and I was wondering if you could repeat that. You know,
yeah, go to our website, go to the website, nationallibertyalliance.org, highlight grand jury, and click on docket, and you'll find it on the docket page towards the bottom. And you'll see 9/11 there. So you click on that. It's 252 pages. And again, we'd like to get that distributed out as much as possible. The people have to do that. The grand jury is not going to directly go do that. If people were to call the grand jury or try to talk with us, we would not be given any interviews. Of course, if they called National Liberty Alliance, from that perspective, we'll talk to them.
Now, when you say you go, because there's several categories in here, which one is it under? Is it under papers filed?
Yeah, it's under grand jury.
I got that. And then you got papers filed, evidence, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, if you click on the docket, okay, you go down, and you go all the way down right where the first video starts. It's right above the first video. You'll see 9/11 evidence PDF.
Okay, great. Yeah, that helps a lot. You know, you were talking about the Building 7. I mean, that's a linchpin of all this. You know, we all saw that building in London, which caught fire, and were totally devastated, and that didn't fall down. And there has been a person with the 9/11 Truth Movement. He's been calling into show with Brian Lamb. What do you call that? And he's been asking, when he interviews these people, he allows people to call in. And they've been calling in. They've been asking all these politicians and muckety-mucks, you know, about 9/11. 9 out of 10 times, they just blow them off. Finally, he got the architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth on, and they did a whole segment on that because it was so much, it was so embarrassing, you know, to the C-SPAN it was, you know, that they were just blowing off these questions. Now, I was also wondering if you got that information about the private attorney general doctrine, if you had a chance to review it and whether or not that would help you.
Well, I've heard people talk about the private attorney general half of forever. Ever since I've been in this, I just don't find anything that I feel comfortable with that. People who call themselves private attorney generals and they have some kind of an identification of such, I don't know what that means. I don't know what it is. I don't know in history, the authority, common law, anything about it. I just don't see anything. So I don't know what that is, to be honest. And obviously, we're not going to do anything in court or try to do anything in court with things we don't understand. Now, I do have someone who is an advisor, has been an advisor to us for quite some time, and they brought that up about a private attorney general. I spoke with him in the past about this, but I didn't dig very deep. But I'll talk with him again about this. Hopefully, I'll be talking with him this week. And come to an understanding of what this is. So I don't have anything. Brent, have you ever heard of the private attorney general and what that is all about?
Yes, there is such a thing. And
so you need to tell us what you know.
Well, I've never done it, and I don't know a lot, but I did maybe give an idea about what it is. It's when a lawyer brings a private action to and obtains an injunction or something to do what the government ought to be doing. And that's the way I've always understood it, and lawyers do that. But the truth is, every time anybody brings an action in court, if he's bringing the right action, he's doing it in defense of the law of the land. And when he does that, he's defending everybody's rights. And that's why it's important, coming back to the fundamentals of the oath, that our Constitution requires those in state and federal government offices and positions to take to defend our Constitution, which is our law of the land, Article 6 says that, to defend it against enemies foreign and domestic. A significant set of words, has historic roots, historical and historic. Again, I dare say most folk that take that oath don't have a clue what they're saying. It just rings pretty in their ears. And you can't expect people to. It's hidden, and hidden on purpose. But to defend our Constitution, our law of the land, is to defend our land. And to defend our law of the land against foreign enemies foreign means that you're willing to take up a gun and defend it. That's what that means. And to defend against enemies, as a member of the militia, by the way, that's a militia's duty, militiaman's duty, and every militia, every able-bodied male is a militiaman. There is a militia. And that's part of the oath. The second duty is to defend against enemies domestic. And that means that you're willing to do a couple of things. You're willing to serve on the jury in defense of the rightness, the right application of the law of the land, and you're willing also to bring an action in court in defense of your own jurisdiction, your own rights, and your rights are your duties. And God gave you fundamental duties, and if you're not willing to defend them, you're a lawless person. And if you're not willing to go to court to fight for them, you're lawless. And you won't, well, everybody's going to suffer. And when you go to court and you defend your own rights, your rights are your duties that are God bestowed, your fundamental rights. When you go to court and defend those, you're defending everybody's rights. I had a friend here, it's been 15 years ago, and he got appointed to defend a murderer. A murderer had brutally murdered his parents. It seemed that there was no getting around it. There was no way he was going to get out of it. Of course, the law demands that his due process be upheld and defended. Well, I appointed this fellow to do it. And boy, did he get a lot of guff, threats to his life and all sorts of things. And he finally came out and publicly said, when I defend a man's rights to due process, and he's innocent until he's proven guilty, no matter what anybody thinks, I'm defending everybody's rights. I hope some of you can understand that, but if you don't, there's not anything I can do for you. And that's the truth. And when you defend your rights, too, but getting back, that's an extreme case, but get back just to defend it when you know that your duties, the government is, or somebody, government or anybody, is impeding your duties that God gave you to do, then you have a duty to be a private attorney general in that sense and to go in and defend it. And civil rights, and I know there's a difference between civil rights and fundamental rights. Fundamental rights are the God-given rights bestowed by God upon the individual, direct, with no intermediary. But evil government has come up with this idea called civil rights. What does civil mean? That means city, city law rights, municipal, as Blackstone puts it. Fashioned by man, called rights, they may or they may not be. Sometimes they are, sometimes they aren't. But civil rights, as it is said in our country, have relied traditionally upon private attorney generals for their enforcement. And that's when a lawyer or anybody brings an action of law to enforce what is really, truly right. And that's what a private attorney general is. Now, people say, well, only a lawyer could do that. No, you can do that yourself. Oh, it might be better if you got a lawyer. It might be helpful. It's good for the perception in front of the jury that somebody is willing to defend you, but you can do that if you're enforcing your own rights. Then we have, for example, RICO statutes, statutes against racketeering. That's what's going on in government now. Government, as my neighbor tells me, is finally off the streets, or crime is finally off the streets and back in government, where it belongs, he says, jokingly, of course. But because of that, we have a federal statute, many states have the statute, called RICO, Racketeering, Influence, and Corrupt Organization Act. And private citizens can sue to enforce these if that racketeering is affecting their duties, their rights, impeding, hampering your rights. So really, that's what a private attorney general is. It's somebody that doesn't have a paycheck from the government defending the rights of others or the rights of himself. I just had a fellow call me tonight, and his wife is going to tax court. She's been abused terrible, and she decided she's going to take him to the mat. I don't know how far she'll get. She knows that it's going to be rough. She's not a talker. And he said, I can't see her going to tax court. I want her to go, but I don't know what to do. But he said, I found a provision for the tax court that says that if a person is incompetent to talk, of course, that's up to the judge, then a husband or any concerned person can be a friend of the court and go in and speak for that person. He said, I think I'm going to try to do that. Well, that's being a private attorney general. So we don't need to, I don't think that we should pump this thing about private attorney generals up too much, except to say it's just men and women doing their duty. That's what it is. Their duty as Americans, and that oath that people take when they get into the government to defend our law of the land, our Constitution, against its enemies, foreign and domestic, that doesn't add any duty to any American, taking that oath. It just strengthens a duty that every American already has. That's what an oath does. It strengthens a duty you already have to do right. And just because you haven't taken that oath does not mean you do not have that duty, and God's not going to hold you to it, because he will. He bequeathed you a land to live on, and with that land comes the law of the land, and he expects all of us. He gives us the jurisdiction to defend it. That's what I know about private attorney general. I suppose I've been one, because I've done some of these kind of cases, but I hadn't heard the phrase until more recently. Back to you,
yeah.
John.
Okay, thank you, Brent. Yeah, well, there's also, it sounds like a provision in the federal courts called the next friend, where an individual can come in and represent somebody, assist someone, give them information, and even speak on their behalf in the court. Although we've had problems both in the federal courts and state courts, and even the lower courts, lower than them, trying to come in to speak on behalf of people to assist them. And they always give us a hard time, and if it's worth it, I say let's make a federal case out of it, because it's an unalienable right to counsel, and counsel is not defined as any kind of a lawyer per se, or a bar lawyer, or bar attorney, or anyone licensed. Counsel is counsel, and that's the key thing I think we can use. The problem we have is credibility. We have to have credibility. Maybe at some point in time, I'll look a little further into this private attorney general thing. I have a friend who tells me that he knows somebody that's very good who could come in and do that. But I'd have to learn to know who this person is and understand, you know, where they're really coming from, because I do know some people that call themselves private attorney general, and they've got a certificate, and I don't think that they know much at all, my opinion. But that's my opinion. I don't think that they really understand the processes. I don't think they understand the real important points. These people that I have come in contact usually are referring or doing the commercial thing, you know, going out after liens, leaning judges. And they're non-judicial liens, by the way, done commercially. We don't get involved in any of that. So all of the private attorney generals that I've met get into the man on the land stuff with the commercial liens, and they also tend to lean towards, this quasi-government, shadow government that's created by this small group of people that, you know, they call themselves judges and private attorney generals and prosecutors and all kinds of different, they give themselves all kinds of different titles. And none of them have knowledge that I'm aware of that makes them worthy of what they're claiming to be and what they're trying to do. But again, that doesn't mean that there isn't no such thing. Brent apparently has some information on that, and I'll look a little deeper. But credibility is the key. We really need to make things work for what we're trying to do. I believe we really need U.S. attorneys given to us from the Attorney General's office to deal with these crimes. Now, if they say, if we can get the permission to get individuals who are attorneys, okay, and we can find some people who are attorneys that understand the common law, and we can get the approval from the Attorney General's office to appoint them as prosecutors, okay, within our case, we'll go that way. Now, remember, they've really got papers, they've got the word, I think it's civil, but they got something. They don't have criminal on it. I think they call it a civil case or something. Now, we have no power to change that or to force them to put what is really necessary. We don't need that word at all. Really, we're going after a lot of criminal cases. And again, you know, desperate times calls for desperate measures. This is extraordinary. We can't get our information into the court. This is a way to do it, to get it into the court on file, up on PACER, out on the record. And that's why we're doing it the way it is. We're forcing their hand to bring our information into the courts and trying to get enough people behind us to help push this through. And, of course, to expose them as much as we can. To hopefully people who are friends of ours that are in government, and eventually get our courts of justice back. And that's what we need to do. All right, anything else, Terry?
Yeah, just one thing. This is a California Law Review article, and I think you should take a look at it because there's like it gives you three points in order to be bring the private attorney general. But one of the most interesting ones I find is the second, and it said the party must show that there was a necessity for private enforcement. This requirement essentially tests whether the public interest advanced by the litigation would have been represented without the plaintiff acting as a private attorney general. Because
where are you reading this from, by the way?
This is from the Law Review article.
Okay.
That I sent you. If you didn't get it, you know, let me know. I'll resend it. But I think that's essentially the case here with your action in New York. The attorney general isn't doing anything about it, and so that's why the private attorney general has to step in.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well. Again, we'll consider it as a possibility in the future. But again, we're really building pressure, and we want to be credible. At the end of the day, we want these people to be tried and the trial to be serious and take effect. And whatever the trial jury decides, we want it executed. And we need to get into the building to be able to do that. I mean, again, all these things that are kind of outside the norm, not to say that it's not done, because I'll have to look a little further into it, but again, it's kind of outside the norm. They will try to prevent us from going forward. They're doing everything they can to prevent us from going forward, to throw us out, to stop sending papers in and so on. So again, it is an uphill battle. I think everything is aligning right now, in my opinion, because of what's going on with the White House right now and what Trump is doing and getting this information concerning his probable knowledge of 9/11 and the fact that we're raising that issue and putting it into the courts and getting it out. The timing looks right. We'll see what happens. We're waiting for that critical mass or that push from people with authority like the President of the United States, like the Attorney General. You know, the Assistant Attorney General, I've heard him speak on a couple occasions, and I'm kind of impressed with him, and I'm wondering, maybe he's a guy that's not tainted. Maybe he's a guy that is going to do the right thing. Maybe he's the guy that's going to become the Attorney General, because hopefully he's going to get rid of Sessions, because I don't think Sessions has the ability or the stamina to do what needs to be done. Ken, you're bleeding through. You're too close to your mic, that new mic of yours.
Okay, I had a person that has a good question for you relative to your comments about taking your foreclosure papers, printing them off, taking them down to the sheriff and to the courthouse. And this person also took them to the company that was doing the auction and threw them to the bank. And she has a question. Could we listen to what she has to say? I can unmute
her.
Sure,
go right ahead. Go right ahead.
I thought I could. Somehow.
You know, to find someone quickly, I found that there is a quicker way to find someone. If you go to that little black box thing.
Hello?
Hang on 1 second. If you go to the little box thing and you highlight, the attendee list, and if you click on that, your attendee list pops up and you can search for an individual.
Right.
So, you knew about that. Okay. Yep. I just discovered that. So.
Okay, this is Felicia from Florida.
Hey, Felicia.
How are you? I'm just kind of confused because I did the OK form, I did the affidavit. You guys sent me the affidavit. You sent it to my bank.
Mm-hmm. You're going to have to get a little closer to your mic or your phone because it's hard to hear you.
Can you hear me now?
Oh, good. Now, yes.
I went down to the courthouse, submitted the United States Grand Jury's documents into my court. I also gave it to the sheriff. I have been in contact with, my brother told me that my house was for sale, and I looked it up online and told them what was going on. Auction.com took it off, and they privately sold my house. And It was dated on
42. Do you know who they sold it to?
No, sir. But the letter, the documents that you guys sent, the mortgage company said that they would not respond because it is not a legal document. Mm-hmm. And if they wanted any information, I had to give consent for their information to send it to you guys.
Right. Well, they can make the claim that it's not a legal document. You know, they've got the summons. The summons is in there. They've got the paper and the show cause requirement. We've laid out very clearly in the document on how they're breaking the law and what they're doing, which is a crime. And if they want to ignore it, then that's fine. You know,
She said that it's not a legal document, so they're not gonna. Their legal team will not respond. They also haven't responded to CFPB as well.
Yeah. Well, bear in mind the problem with them is they can't respond. Okay, because in order for them to respond, they either have to lie or admit the truth, and that's the problem. They don't want to, you know, go. They know what they look at. What they can't respond and lie. So, and they can't admit the things in there because they're going to lose the case that way. So the only option they have is to default and hopefully try to do something with the judge. Again, we don't have a judge in here. We have a magistrate, although we did have a judge that came and committed fraud on the case. But, you know, we've dealt with him as best we can, and they're still taking our papers and we're still filing papers. And again, we know we have to wait for that critical mass. So again, people are going to do what they want to do, but at some point in time, they can only ignore us so long, and they're going to have to pay the piper. And you know, the harder they play, then the more the option of a criminal process is going to be. You know, we keep giving them their opportunity.
When I gave it to the sheriff's office, they called me and told me that I need to actually come down and write a statement that a crime was actually committed. And I said, well, have you read it? And he told me no.
Well, no, I would suggest to you not to go down and do something like that.
I haven't.
Yeah, because we don't know what's behind that. The crime is very clearly laid out in the paperwork, okay? And of course, unfortunately, you know, people like the sheriff and so on, they just won't read it because they figure they can't understand it. I mean, God forbid they did read it and they did understand it. And I think our paperwork is that simple and yet on point that it is easy to read. And we put a lot of footnotes in there in order for people to understand the meaning of certain words that they may not understand. All of that information, it just needs for them to read it. Now, the other thing is they'll send it to an attorney, and an attorney will look at it, and of course, this is a bunch of garbage, don't worry about it. You know, and why they act that way, and I'm sure there's many, many reasons. You know, the fact that we are calling ourselves the Unified Common Law Grand Jury, and we did that to separate ourselves from the puppet jury, and also... they may try to come out after us legally in some legal way, trying to, come under the guise of the grand jury or the trial jury as they understand it. So that's why we make it clear with the common law grand jury. And the only reason we're unified, there should really be no reason or need for a unified grand jury. It's kind of absurd on one end, but they've unified the courts, and that's absurd too, isn't it? So we just copied what they did, so they kind of understand that. And of course, the reason we did that was so that we can deal with subversion against the United States of America from enemies both foreign and domestic, from every single state of the union. It's happening throughout the whole judicial process. All the federal courts, the state courts, they're all part of this crime. We do have organized crime going on, RICO in the courts. That's what we got going on. And I think there are very, very few judges that don't, play in that. And I don't know how they're able to continue being judges in that system. I just don't know how they can do it. But I'm sure there are some. Let's hope.
But this is my mortgage company. They don't even want to respond to you guys.
Yeah, well, that's okay. We're going to
default. So what am I supposed to do now?
Well, the only thing we can do for you is wait for the default date. Once that default date comes through, we're going to start pressuring this magistrate to do his administrative duties, which is to sign the default. The law is crystal clear. The process and procedure is crystal clear. You send people papers, they respond, or they don't. And if they don't, then they default, and in the wherefore clause, that is executed. And all we're asking for is to return people back to the former state they were in the beginning. We're not asking for anything further. Now, you can go and sue beyond that. We're not going to do that for you. We'll get involved in that at this point in time because, again, we want to just get people's homes back or get them compensated for the homes that were taken away from them.
I'm still in mine. They're trying to get me out of it real quick.
Well, let's put it this way. Let me ask you this way. We know how they do it. There's a game they're playing while they're doing all this paperwork and stuff and just ignoring you. They're changing. They're filing false papers is what they're doing and taking fiduciary authority. Yeah. They're taking through a claim on you and then they're transferring the ownership or the name of your property to someone else's ownership. It's all illegal.
Yeah, John had sent her a release form to release her financial information and information about the common law grand jury.
I'm sorry, say this again.
They have also sent her a release form so that they can have access to her financial records and something about the common law grand jury as well.
Yeah.
The best sent me a release form.
You got to get back to your mic or your head or your phone because we're not getting you. Try it again.
The bank
sent me a release form. They said in order you guys are considered a third party, and in order for me to send you guys the information, you guys had to sign it, and I had to sign it, and I had to send it back in.
Yeah.
And I said,
listen to me. Anything from any organization, any corporation, or any government agency, or anybody anywhere requiring your signature, forms, information, details, financials, anything concerning this case or any case you have going, you should stay away from that. I don't know what that's all about. Of course, you know, these lawyers, they create all this kind of stuff on the one hand. But the other side of this thing is you don't know what it means. I don't know what it means, and I would stay away from it. And why should you? All we're doing coming in, if they don't understand that the grand jury is the sureties of the peace, we get that from Magna Carta, that's the process of the tribunal. They are here to secure the peace, to get in between the government and the people. To say yay or nay concerning people being taken into a court. And that's the whole process. If they can't understand that, and I know they're ignorant to these things. They're ignorant to the truth. They're ignorant to the common law. They're ignorant to the rights, unalienable rights. They're ignorant to the meaning of the unalienable rights. And how is it that they can possibly understand some of the things we're doing when they don't want to? I mean, they can understand this if they were to take it, read it very carefully, look at the footnotes, see where our authorities come from, maybe even look into some of those authorities, maybe go read a real book on law, like The Excellence in Common Law here. You know, let them go read something like that, and they will understand it, but they don't want to. And they've got their game, their con game going, and they're not used to anything. And I'll tell you what, their con game that they got going, and they keep putting it back on us the way they do it, and we keep moving, and we call the spade the spade. It is what it is. Okay, at some point in time, it's all going to backfire on them. It's all more proof. It's just more nails in their coffin. It's more proof of their crimes. It's more proof of their conspiracy, of their RICO. It's the mechanism that they're using. So time is
well, when I asked her when I had asked her, I said, "Well, you need my signature to send my information to the grand jury." I said, "But you sent all my financial information to CFPB," and she said, "Oh, because it's federal."
Well, look it. Listen carefully. It is a summons, okay? They have to respond, okay, to the people, and they can respond to the court directly, okay? And they're not going to respond. I'm good with that. Case closed, they lose. Now, we may not be able to apply, the default right away. Again, it depends on how much pressure is on this magistrate at that time. Look, there's a lot of pressure on him not to do anything right. But we're putting the pressure on the other side to do the just thing. And it's a game of time. This next paperwork that we are filing right now, again, is going to put more pressure on every paper we file in our court case and share with the Judicial Committee and a couple of congressmen and with the president and with Sessions. Is just more and more pressure on them. And so it's going to take time. It's an uphill battle.
So I'm just supposed to sit and just get kicked out?
Well, again, we're doing the best we can to help you, but we're all
if the sheriff's office is supposed to follow the Constitution, then
We've had a sheriff tell us once, and not me directly, but people involved with us, that I'm not going to obey the Constitution. I'm going to obey the court, or I'm going to obey to what the lawyer tells me, and because that's how ignorant they are. Look, there is nothing more dangerous than ignorance in action. Nothing. Okay, and these people have taken control. They have taken control of our judiciary process. Okay, they're holding it hostage. They're holding our courts hostage, and we're out here trying to get in to get justice applied. It's going to take time.
They don't look at it as a summons. They don't look at it as a summons, because when I spoke to her, she was like, yeah, the letter you sent, and I said, well, I didn't send that letter. The United States Grand Jury.
Well, they're pretty dumb, or they're plain ignorant, or whatever. Look, I don't make the summons, okay? I do create the summons, but
they
court...
They call it a letter.
Carefully. Listen very carefully, okay? I have to put together the summons. I bring it into the clerk, and the clerk stamps and seals the summons. That makes it official, okay? And we had hundreds of summonses that we had collected at the time when we went for our summonses. So every time we send out paperwork, we attach a summons to it. That is a court order requiring them to respond to an open case. And if they want to ignore it, and they got a stupid lawyer that's really that dumb, okay, to ignore this, and to then they're going to default. Now, yes, it is true. When they default, it may take a while they may need more pressure before it becomes applicable, where we can now apply it, okay, and press it and get the signature off of the, because we put our signature and seal on the default on two papers already. We sent it in to the magistrate who had placed for his seal and signature, and he hasn't signed it yet. So how many papers is he going to have to get? How long is it going to have to be before he finally breaks down to sign it, realizing, wait a second, I'm going to go to jail too. I'm starting to see the winds of change coming. I'm starting to see the pressure piling in. Maybe I'm realizing now that they're going to get ready to send some U.S. attorneys to come deal with this. That's when it's going to happen.
Hey,
and
John,
when is that going to be? I don't know.
They call it a letter and not a summons.
Well,
they call it a letter and not a summons.
Can I say something here?
Sure.
Okay. They have to call it a letter, because otherwise they'd have to respond to it. It is not a letter. It has a clerk stamp on it, and it was filed in the court. So it doesn't matter what they call it. The fact is it's in the case, and you don't answer things in a case with letters or on the phone. I don't know. You must have talked to them on the phone, but they are. If they think it's a letter, and they think this and they think that, they have to put that in writing, and they need to enter it on the docket. They're not doing that. So what they're doing is they're violating due process, because that thing was entered in the court with a clerk stamp on it. I don't give a crap what they call it. It needs to be answered. If they think it's a letter, then they need to put in there, this is a letter. They didn't do that, though, did they? Because they don't dare do that, do they? Because now they'll open up a dialogue where we can argue and say, no, it's not a letter, it's this. And they don't even want to go there. But you need to push that. You need to say, no, this is not a letter. I don't do things by letter. This is official filing. It's stamped by the clerk. It's on the court docket, and it better be in there, because if it's not, that's a 10-year jail sentence for the clerk or whatever it is. And you need to answer it, and you need to answer it officially in the docket. Not by saying, oh, we need a third party. See, that's why they want us to sign things, because what they do is they get us, by our signature and your signature, you're acknowledging that it's a letter. not a letter.
And here's the other. Let's look at the facts. Let's look at the facts, though, here of what really is going on. Only one of two things are going to happen, and it's going to happen in the near future. And the near future could be a year, it could be a month. I don't know what that is, but it's going to happen. One of the two is going to happen. There's no doubt about it. And that is, number one, either we're going to get justice back in these courts, or number two, these people are going to force a civil war, okay? And, yeah. And I think it's going to be very short, because look at most of the people are waking up. And most of the people will follow the multitude anyway, because that's just the nature of things. And I think we have the multitude. They have to pay their people to come out to be active. We come out because we're involved, because we see the injustice, and we want to fix it, and we got to stop it, and we don't want to lose our nation. We know what it's all about. We have the same problem our founding fathers have had. Nothing is different. Nothing has changed. Okay? It's the same problem. And we need to take it back. And this is how one of the ways that we could take it back. I don't know of any other way. And I've challenged people over the years. If anybody can figure another way to do what we're trying to do, I'd like to see it. But we've got the most logical and, in my opinion, obvious way of taking back this nation. And it's peaceful. It fulfills Kennedy's point concerning a peaceful revolution. Okay, it's peaceful. And it's just, and it's right. And we're doing it with honor, justice, and mercy, and coming with compassion. We're trying to be honorable people. And that places us on the side of God, okay? These people are obviously against God. They're against justice. We want to bring God, the king, back into the court where he belongs. This is his, and it's going to be his will. It's going to happen. It's going to be his will. And if it's not his will, then it's not going to be his will. But I don't, and that shouldn't concern us, the end result, because that's up to the Lord. But we need to do the right thing, and that's what we need to be doing, getting busy about in our life, no matter what it is. Whatever it is, just do the right thing, and that's the thing you need to do. Successful or not, that's not important. You know, we may lose all the battles, but at the end, we'll win the war. I've read the end of the book, and I'm sure you have too. Mm-hmm. We're going to win.
Yep. I just want to bring something up that Scalia said just shortly before he died, within that year. There was a case that came through the Supreme Court. They wanted the Supreme Court to pass a law that had something to do with, I don't remember specifically what it was, but Scalia said, listen, it's not necessary. He said the people still have due process, and that's what they should be pushing and resting in, is their due process. So he understood that everything that the government's doing to us and the corporations are doing to us, it's all violations of due process. You don't.
And that's our mantra, by the way, and that's our battle. Did he say that? Then he said he's seen some of our papers, because we've sent him some papers, and he said this right before he died?
Yes. It was,
maybe he's referring to some degree with what we're doing, because that is our mantra. We want due process. We want is due process in a court of justice.
What are they denying Felicia? We're not going to answer that. That's a letter. They're violating her due process.
That's right. You
need to use those words and put those words in your case. Look at it. This is not a letter. It's filed. It's stamped in the court, and they need to answer on the record, because I'm fighting this fight on the record, not on the phone. Not in letter motions or these other things that we have no idea what they are, from some kind of foreign jurisdiction or foreign rules that we don't know about. You need to answer on the record. Otherwise, you're violating my due process. And that's what you're going to end up suing them over in the end anyway. That's where you're going to get...
Just to let you know, just a little bit, you're over-modulating every once in a while, so you can lower your mic level a little bit. I know I had to go to my Skype to lower it. But wherever you got to go.
Oh, I see. Right. That's right.
Either that or push the mic just a little further away from your mouth.
Oh, it's across the screen here, far away.
Oh, okay.
So basically, I need to just wait.
Yeah, it's a waiting game. And I wouldn't leave until the sheriff throws you out, because the only one that could really throw you out is the sheriff. They do have a game and that's going on. But bear in mind, look, they're going to get their default soon, aren't they? We're going to send them that default, and we're going to put it into the court for signature of the judge. And that, let's see what they do then.
She called it a letter. She said the letter that you wrote. I said that I didn't write the letter. The United States Grand Jury wrote that. I didn't write that.
But it was filed in the case, Felicia. It was filed in the case. So therefore, it's not a letter. It's a
document filed in the case that if it's removed, right. Its concealment or removal is it's all a crime.
And they can't say we're not going to answer it. What are they doing? Making up the rules as they go along? They need to answer. They need to answer either way.
Right. Well, anyway, we need to move on. But do what you got to do. Fight the battle. We're trying our best to help you save your home. And bear in mind, if you lose your home, one thing or another is going to happen. Either we are going to win this battle, or we're going to be at civil war in this nation. And again, I think it's going to go quick when that happens. And I think the majority of the people are going to wake up, and they're going to lose. That's my opinion. They're losing control. They don't have control anymore. But in any event, okay, at some point in time, this thing's going to stop moving, and they got to now restore you. That's what the default is requiring, restoration to your original state before this whole thing started. And then you could take them to court and sue them for more. But at that point, I think we would be more involved in the criminal side of things, and we probably would be able to work some things out and deal with these people from a different perspective, which we're not going to talk about right now. There is another plan that we can execute at that point in time and assist the people to get restitution, But to be restored first and foremost to the original state, okay? So we're doing the best we can on our end, and you need to do what you got to do and keep fighting them and praying.
It's just sad. It is just bad.
Well, remember, the hearts of men is desperately wicked. Who could know it, And these are people that are in control have desperately wicked hearts. The lust for money and power or whatever it is, that's where they're at. And we're in a world where Satan is prince and power of. So hey, we shouldn't not expect this. So double negative.
Oh, I already know. They already know wrath is coming.
We wrestle against powers, So, all right. Well, thanks for the call. I appreciate it, Felicia.
Thank you. Have a great evening.
Okay. I guess Terry's gone, so let's go to the next call. Looks like April from North Carolina. Let me try to hit the next button for April. Go right ahead, April. Somebody's been unmuted. I don't know why there's constantly a mic up there, a phone with no name next to it. Jan,
we had
wonder
one
what
would
happen if I X that one out.
I think we had one person that did not put any information up there.
Okay, well, I picked that person, and let's see what happens. Is a blank person up there?
Are you hearing me? This is Allie.
Go ahead, Allie. How you doing, Allie?
Oh, well, I am just delighted that you finally called on me. I have information to share about the Bundys and the Trump.
Go ahead.
I'm looking at on my screen right now about a lobbyist extraordinaire and Trump campaign advisor. Roger Stone's name was fading from the headlines post-election. Instead of trying to waste time using my words or echoing theirs, it says, the longtime political strategist whose illustrious career spans more than four decades may have chosen his newest cause, defending the Bundy family. To return him to the public
are
eye...
Are you talking about Stone?
Yes, and what he has done and working... it involves, Clive and Ammon and Ryan Bundy.
Well, I'm glad to see
and
him on that because he's got some leverage, no doubt. But go right ahead.
Okay. His newest celebrity involves Clive and Ammon, the Bundys, 2014, famously initiated an armed standoff against the Bureau of Land Management at their Nevada ranch when the agency came to collect overdue grazing fees incurred by the family's patriarch, Cliven Bundy. In 2016, Ayman Bundy perpetuated another standoff when he and his supporters occupied the Mahler Federal Wildlife Refuge in Oregon, right next door to me. Ayman was acquitted for his part in Mahler, but he and Ryan and Cliven are currently facing trial for their roles in Nevada. So he made his support for the Bundys and their followers public when he spoke at a Las Vegas fundraiser on July 15th. After stepping up to the stage, his first words, partially drowned out by attendees' applause, were, "I am here for one reason. I stand in solidarity with every member of the Bundy family." He went on to call the FBI agents involved in ending the Mahler occupation federal mercenaries, claiming Lavoie Finicum, otherwise known as Tarp Man, was murdered in cold blood, which brought death and dishonor to our country. According to Stone, the government's prosecution of the Bundys is the oppressive hand of a military jackbooted government that has lost all sense of reality and law, morality, or the U.S. Constitution. Further, he denounces Gloria Navarro, the Nevada judge presiding over the Battle of Bunkerville trial, as outrageous, unconstitutional, and a disgrace to the judiciary. These sentiments are in line with many of the Bundy supporters who have disparaged the judge's reputation and made a number of veiled threats against her, which Stone's words are more likely to validate than prevent. So I think that's really good news that is happening. Now, one that just absolutely.
And we got to bear in mind, you know, the head of this whole problem was Comey and also the governor up there. So those
I think the ones that pressed it forward
to kill, Lavoie Finicum.
Yes. So that's what I have to share about the Bundys. Now about Trump. And this is from the Duran.com site. And it reads, yesterday I wrote an article, and this was posted 4 days ago, which I expressed the view that the president's statement published in connection with U.S. President Trump's signing of the new sanctions law passed against his wishes by the U.S. Congress clearly pointed to an intention to bring a future challenge against the sanctions law to the U.S. Supreme Court. The person known as Simon has pointed out on the thread of this article that President Trump's signing statement, the one which is actually attached to the law itself, goes much further and not only details where the president's lawyers, which in this case means the White House legal counsel and the Department of Justice, think the sanction laws fall into outright illegality, but makes the intention of bringing a challenge to the U.S. Supreme Court. And here is President Trump's beginning of his statement. I won't read the whole thing because it's kind of long, but he says, "Today I have signed into law H.R. 3364, the Countering America's Adversaries Through Sanctions Act. While I favor tough measures to punish and deter aggressive and destabilizing behavior by Iran, North Korea, and Russia, this legislation is significantly flawed. In its haste to pass this legislation, the Congress included a number of clearly unconstitutional provisions. For instance, although I share the policy views of sections 253 and 257, those provisions purport to displace the president's exclusive constitutional authority to recognize foreign governments, including their territorial bounds, in conflict with the Supreme Court's recent decision in Zivitovsky versus Kerry. Additionally, Section 216 seeks to grant the Congress the ability to change the law outside the constitutionally required process. The bill prescribes a review period that precludes the president from taking certain actions. Certain provisions in Section 216, however, conflict with the Supreme Court's decision in INS versus Chadha because they purport to allow Congress to extend the review period through the procedures that do not satisfy the requirements for changing the law under Article 1, Section 7 of the Constitution. I nevertheless expect to honor the bill's extended waiting periods to ensure that Congress will have a full opportunity to avail itself from the bill's review procedures. Further, certain provisions, such as 254 and 257, purport to direct my subordinates in the executive branch to undertake certain diplomatic initiatives in contravention of the President's exclusive constitutional authority to determine the time, scope, and objectives of international negotiations. I mean, it goes on, and then he says, finally, my administration particularly expects the Congress to refrain from using this flawed bill to hinder our important work with Europe allies to resolve the conflict in Ukraine and from using it to hinder our efforts to address any unintended consequences it may have for American businesses, our friends, or our allies. So, yes, he is avoiding impeachment, trap in sanction laws, and prepares to challenge the U.S. Supreme Court. I yield.
All right. Well, thank you, Ali, for, you know, telling us or sharing it with us. And, there's no doubt about what Congress is doing. And, you know, we've been talking a lot about the deep state lately. And I think what we need to do is try to identify the players of the deep state. I mean, we already got some of their names, is absolutely clear. We know that Mueller is one of them. We know that Comey is one of them. We know Bush is one of them and Clinton. But we need to really start to identify these people and really get a list of these people and list them up. So anybody who's got information on anybody that we can clearly define as part of the deep state, again, we should do that. Hold on one second.
Excuse me for interrupting.
Jen, I see you put Allie's name up there, but I'm wondering if someone else comes in with a clean slate like that, everyone's going to appear with that, no? I'm wondering whether it's wise. How did you come in, Allie? Did you come in by phone?
Yes, I did.
Okay, and I'm surprised they let you through without caller ID, because they try to
identify
everyone.
Caller ID must be blocked.
Yeah. All right, well, anyway, I think you should remove that, because I think everyone that comes in that blank was going to come in as Allie. But whatever. Go ahead, Ali. You wanted to say something else?
Well, my final statement on this, because he is exactly 2 months younger than or older than me, born on June 14th, 1946. He's a Gemini, sign of the twins. And I liken that to the Native Americans' legend about the two wolves. And which one is he feeding? Well, he's feeding them both. So I don't like him. I don't dislike him. But I think he is feeding some of the wolves. But on the other hand, I think he's feeding the good wolf, too.
Yeah, I think he's stuck between a rock and a hard place. I think he understands.
Oh, he really is. I mean, I wouldn't want his job.
Yeah,
and I think it's really interesting why he is on that 21-day vacation. And what the pundits are telling us, it's because they're remodeling the White House and updating the air conditioning system.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, look at the bottom line is.
Thank you for calling on me, and I yield.
Okay. Thank you. The bottom line is he's in the den, and he's got to deal with them, and I believe he knows exactly what he's doing. He's in a tough place, playing a tough game, and I think he's the perfect individual for doing this. Obviously, you know, he's accomplishing a lot. All right, let's move to our next caller. Thanks, Ali. April, go right ahead.
Hello.
How did you get in there, Ali?
It doesn't sound like April.
I hit star six, and here I am.
Wow.
Okay, I've got a couple of comments on the Bundy trial, and then I got a couple of comments on the Trump adventure. Two or three weeks ago, the prosecutors demanded that they get a copy of the closing arguments of the defense before they even get up and give it, okay? Andrea, her update today, I didn't get a chance to watch it yet, but her headline or blurb about it was, the prosecutors that they want to interview the defense witnesses and then bring the trial in. Okay. They're doing everything they can. That would tell me they have no confidence in their ability to get convictions whatsoever.
Well, yeah, again, they're not permitting these people to defend themselves. And people have a right to defend themselves, and they're not permitting that. They have a right to call witnesses. They have the right to produce their evidence. And no judge should be able to stop that. Even if it's stupid, dumb evidence, and doesn't help them, I mean, hey, they have the right to do it. And, of course, it's not stupid, dumb evidence. The point is, it's... You know, they got a good case. Look, at anybody who hears the Bundy case, sits down and listens to what really is going on here, it would definitely go not guilty. As a matter of fact, let's put the judge and the prosecutors and the FBI and all these other people on trial.
Well, from all the comments I'm getting from the people out there observing the trial, that they are saying that the jury's reactions point to the fact that they're not buying a single bit of it. Okay, so I really look for acquittals, just like up in Portland in that case. I'm open. Okay, now, let me say this. If you want to secure a building, a missile facility, or a nuclear facility, you call in the Navy and the Marines, and that comes from firsthand experience. I'll spend hours guarding missiles facilities and sometimes with nukes. Now, you get a four-star admiral or four-star Marine general in charge, especially those that came up through the ranks. And I think Kelly is a Mustang. He come up from enlisted all the way to four-star general. He's had some high profile commands. Now, all my life, if somebody says something that rings a bell in my mind, I remember that. I'll put it into a save this for later, Ben. During Trump's one of his rallies, he said something about 9/11, and all of a sudden, the timbre of his voice changed. His eyes turned to steel, and he said, "I'm going to get to the bottom of that." Okay. Now, going into the White House situation, I don't care whether you call that an evacuation or a vacation. And that article reminded me of something. Right after 9/11, they totally tore the White House, gutted it out, and built new walls in there. Now, all of a sudden... that Kelly comes in there and they're looking for leaks. All of a sudden, Trump and the staff is out of the White House and they're totally tearing the walls down again. And they're saying it was crawling with bugs. I really believe that. But the significant part about this is it is a step in the right direction, and it is a major victory for the White House to eliminate all the bugs and start eliminating the leaks, okay? And it tells me that Trump is still three or four steps ahead of him, and it gave me confidence in Kelly, at General Kelly, okay? But that event is very significant. And it is awesome. I think the first time in history that a Marine general come in and evacuated the White House.
Yeah.
But that is very interesting. And I heard 14 days, and this gal said something about 21 days. I don't think he'll be gone for 21 days. I doubt if he's gone for 2 weeks. However, that White House is secure now, and also come out in that article that it incriminated Mueller a lot more. Well, he was FBI director during 9/11, just like Comey was the FBI director during Mall here in the assassination of LaVoy Finicum. You know, they got tracks.
Right.
And they got records, and this is all coming out. And I think that events like this are proven to me that the tides are turning, and they are turning big time. And then if you ever seen a wave come in and hit a big seawall and go whoom, and when that wave goes back out, it has a lot of power. And whatever, and if it hits a beach, whatever debris and everything on there, it's going out to sea. Well, I see that happening right now. All this trash and stuff is being swept out. Its swamp is being drained. And with that, I yield.
Okay, thank you, Ali. All right, well, we're about at the end of the program, but I want to bring April in, so because we've been calling on April, and she hasn't been able to get up here. But April, go right ahead. You got the mic.
Oh, I'm finally unmuted.
Yep.
I just had a question. I heard a new term today, and I was wondering if you could explain it. I never heard of a writ of actual innocence, and I was wondering what it was.
Well, I've never heard of it either. I don't know if Brent's still on, if he's heard of it. Maybe he might want to make a comment, but I have no clue. So, Brent, are you here? All right, he might have left us. So.
Okay.
All right, anything
maybe
else, April?
Time.
I've never heard of it. Oh, yes, Brent, hold on. Let me pick him out. Let me unmute him. Let's try to unmute him without losing April here. Jen, can you find Brent in the other line here where we can unmute him? I'm looking to try to get him. Hold on a minute. All right, well, let me do this. Let me pick Brent up. Is there anything else you want to make a comment? Because we're at the end anyway, so.
Nah, I just wanted to ask about that.
Okay, let me get Brent in here. Go right ahead, Brent.
John, if you could repeat for me, I didn't understand exactly what she said.
Okay, I can unmute her. She's still in the box there. Go ahead. Ask the question for Brent. Maybe he can answer that.
I was wondering what a writ of actual innocence is.
Oh, I didn't hear that. Although a writ of actual innocence, a writ is, I'll say this, just try to work through it. I'd never heard of that, but a writ is always a command. In the courts. If the courts are talking about a writ, they're talking about a command in writing from a greater to a lesser. In other words, from a higher court to a lower court. A writ of petition for a writ of certiorari means a request for the Supreme Court of a state or the federal court to command the lower court to send them a record, the record of the case. When you say a writ of innocence, then it has to be, if it's a writ, like a writ of habeas corpus, that's a request for a command to bring the body before the court. A writ of innocence would have to be a command. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
It's a petition for a writ of innocence.
Well, I suppose that
that's a little different now because it's a petition for a writ, no?
Yes.
That would be a petition for a writ. That's like a petition for writ of habeas corpus. I've never heard of it, but that's what it would have to be, something like a command about innocence to a lower court.
Yeah, so, I mean, what kind of a case is this? Are you hearing this in? Where are you hearing this in? I mean, can you get the paperwork on this writ?
Well, actually, it's one of the inmates that I'm in contact with. He actually is studying law while he's in there, and he told me another way to go is a petition for a writ of actual innocence.
Okay. Well, again, you know, we don't want to get an example. I'll put that in Google, see if something shows up somewhere online somewhere, but I don't know. So,
okay.
We're going to end our program there. Thanks, April. And Lord willing, we'll be back next Monday. And, of course, we've got a lot of activities going on during the week. We've always got conference calls going on. People should get involved in committees and get active. And also, don't forget, if you're not supporting NLA, please donate $5 a month or more. Keep us going. Okay. Good night, everybody.
Good night.